I'm going to call the meeting to order. This is the meeting Legislative Task Force on Access to Affordable Childcare, and we are meeting in room 1200 of the Minnesota Senate Building, and it's Monday, October 17th. Welcome to the meeting tonight. We have some of our members are not able to be here. Representative Purcell and Senators Senjum and Nelson were not able to be here tonight. Representative Flanagan is planning to come, and she will be here sometime later. So very much appreciate Representative Albright and Franson and Senator Johnson being here. I know it's a really busy time for people to make other meetings, so we will defer approving minutes from the September meeting till either later, or we'll approve them in the November meeting because we do not have a quorum present at this time. And I provided in your packets the work plan that was created at the beginning of the task force, just to help orient you to the agenda tonight. What we had listed, Laura Larson had put this together, and we've got the charges of the task force on the first page. And then on the second and third pages are the different sort of May statements that are included in the legislation that we may review as part of this task force. And so when I put the agenda together for tonight's meeting, I referred to either charges or tasks on the agenda, and that's where that comes from. So the first, sounds like the microphone's turned up. So the first item on the agenda is to talk about reviewing current provider levels. Charge one is to review the loss of child care providers in the state. So we'll have a presentation regarding that from Marnie Warner. We also talk about evaluating access to culturally appropriate child care. And we have Cisa Keller here, is from Think Small. And we will consider options. One of the tasks was to consider options for exit interviews, interviews with providers who leave the child care field. And we'll have a presenter from MAXA who is here to discuss that. So first, we'd like to talk about just the loss of child care providers in the state from a high level. And we found that recently a report was issued by the Center for Rural Policy and Development on rural reality child care shortage. And Marnie Warner has come today to give us a presentation based on that report. And if you'd like to come forward and get started with that, we'd really appreciate it. This report focuses on rural Minnesota, but also covers kind of statewide the loss of providers and the effects on Minnesota families. And I included a link in the meeting notice about, or that has the full report, but I didn't print copies of that. So I do also have a PDF version of the report that we can send out, or we'll post online if you want to read the whole report. So thank you very much for coming tonight.
Is this the right? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We choose topics that we believe are important to rural policy, top rural policy issues to look at. And one of the issues we really wanted to do this year was to look at the shortage in child care. And so the result of it was the article that you referenced there. And so here is a presentation that's basically an overview of that article. And so if you have any questions or anything, or just, if I'm talking too fast or anything, just let me know. It is a statewide issue, very definitely, but it also very definitely differs from one part of the state to the next. In the Twin Cities, you can see that there's definitely a shortage. In the southwest Minnesota, a little bit less, but it's still pretty much a I guess you could call it a crisis all over the state. I talk to people in every region of the state. This map is divided by the Initiative Foundation regions, just to give some oversight to the state. And everybody looked at it as a serious problem, not just for families, but for businesses and for the economic development of their communities. And so we found that there is definitely a high demand and a shrinking supply. Minnesota ranks third in the nation, according to the census data, in the number of households with children under age 6 that had all parents in the workforce. At 74%, we were behind Iowa and South Dakota at 75%, so we're basically tied for first place. Between 2006 and 2015, the number of licensed in-home family child care providers decreased by 27% for a loss of 36,500 spaces, and that's just in licensed child care in both centers this is just in family. In that same time period, the number of child care centers increased by 8% and the capacity grew by 27%. So there was definitely a change there. That was enough to fill about two-thirds of the lost capacity. But looking at the statewide numbers masks a very great difference between the Twin Cities and the rest of the state. So as you can see in these charts, the lines below the zero lines in both charts are family child care. And on the left is licensed child care providers. On the left is child care capacity. And so you can see that in family child care, in both the number of providers and in the capacity, the number of spaces, there was a precipitous drop in the last 10 years, and that's a trend that's actually been going on for the last 20 years, from what I understand, since the 90s. The lines above the zero line are the center-based child care and how it has fared in the same decade. And you can see that the number of centers increased in the Twin Cities by 15%. It dropped in greater Minnesota by 2%. The capacity went up 31% in the Twin Cities and 18% in greater Minnesota. And that looks not too bad until you look at this table here, which shows the number of child care spaces that were lost due to the change in or the loss of child care providers in greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities. And then the gain in capacity in child care centers. And you can see that the net change was quite different from between the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota. In the Twin Cities, there was a gain of 3,000 spaces. In greater Minnesota, there was a loss of 15,000 spaces net. Greater Minnesota is far more dependent on family child care. They represent about 90% of the providers. And in the Twin Cities, they represent about 77%. So child care centers, 10% in greater Minnesota, about 23% in the Twin Cities. And while capacity due to centers grew in greater Minnesota, it did not make up for that loss in family child care capacity. So some of the reasons for why family child care providers are leaving, and this was what we found in many conversations with providers, with people who work with providers, in particular the Initiative Foundations, and people from various other organizations that work in the child care field. And in part, the baby boom generation is retiring. So we're seeing that same drop in workers in this category of industry that we would in any other. And subsequent generations are just choosing other places to work. A very high percentage of in-home child care providers are women. It's like 98, 99%. And, you know, when you think 30, 40 years ago, the opportunities were quite different for women back then. Now women have many more options to go to, and so when they look at the option of child care and see that it is very hard to make a living at it and may not be able to make break even, as one person put it, why would they go to college and get their degree and then go into a field where they can't pay off their student loans? And so they have a difficult time making a living at it. There seems to be a disconnect all over the state where providers are unable to cover the cost of providing child care at the rate that parents are willing to or can afford to pay. And in greater Minnesota, incomes in general tend to be lower and sometimes much lower, but expenses are not necessarily lower, especially when you consider that licensing and training are going to be fairly similar in cost around the state. If a provider buys curriculum online, that will be the same from place to place. Another big issue that came up that I'm sure that has been a real point of discussion is regulations. That was probably the thing I heard loudest about besides the costs. It was a little hard to tell if people were just upset about the regulations or if there really was a problem, but it was such a consistent discussion that it seemed like it really did need to be addressed. It does seem that there needs to be some kind of a review, and I know this was discussed in the committee hearings that were held last fall about this. The training requirements increased from 8 to 16 hours, and as many people told me, training is good for the providers, but it can be very hard to access in rural areas. There's a travel issue. There's the cost of overnight stays because you may have to travel quite a distance to get to training. Classes get canceled because of low registration, which can make it difficult for providers to get their training in a year. But we did see that there are several organizations that are stepping up to help make training more accessible, and the providers are reacting and taking advantage of those situations. Certain groups are hit harder. This became very apparent in the research. Low-income households in particular, with single parents who don't have another parent to fall back on or another family member to step in and look after the children. Children with special needs in minority households and non-English speaking and immigrant households in particular, especially in greater Minnesota, are extremely difficult to find, especially for children with special needs. And as for immigrant households, we have large pockets of immigrants all around greater Minnesota who are not necessarily looking for just any child care. They would like to have culturally appropriate child care. But as you can see from the chart, this came from the DHS report from 2009 from their child care survey, that they are in the group of people who felt that they needed to take any child care that they can get. And then probably the number one thing that I heard consistently is that infant care is in just a crisis. It's almost not to be had, and people are desperately seeking infant care and calling, a year and a half before they even, the prospective child might be born, trying to find a space and trying to make a reservation. This, of course, all leads up to an impact on business. And the thing that we found is that because child care has always been considered mostly a family issue, it's been considered a personal issue and something that the families need to work out for themselves. But now there seems to be a growing awareness amongst businesses that this is really having an impact on their employees. If their employees can't find adequate child care, they may be preoccupied about it at work and affecting their work. They're finding that people are turning down well-paying jobs in their communities because they can't find a place to they find that there isn't any child care in the community. It is a top reason for absenteeism, and it adds up to lost productivity. And parents who can't find suitable child care will just quit work and stay home. This is a big opportunity for businesses. Some are starting to provide their own child care or are working with organizations and providers in the community. And I had a quote there from one CEO who took it upon himself for his company to start their own child care center in their town, saying that it's just a responsibility of business. And then we included several recommendations in the report, and these were the top ones that, you know, from our research seemed to be the ones that people were talking the most about and were getting the most attention. And there was the issue of to be sure that even though it looks like child care centers are growing at a healthy rate, that's not the case. There are many counties that don't have any child care centers at all in them. And then the issue of county licensers, that seemed to be a big issue that people were a little too polite to talk about, but were able to discuss in, it was enough added together to figure out that there was an issue there. And some people spoke about it quite plainly at the committee hearings last fall. And this particular recommendation came from the bill that was introduced in the last session, and it seemed to fit very well with what I was hearing, and so we included that. And then to track and study child care options for underserved groups, just to increase the amount of information out there. And that is the presentation.
Thank you very much. Do you plan to do any further ongoing study of this issue, or is this something that you will come back to, or is it more?
Madam Chair, it is something we would like to return to, but since we're a staff of two, and we have, and I'm the lone writer, we have other topics that we need to cover too. But it is something that we may in the future outsource to somebody or partner with somebody to continue the work on it if there seems to be enough interest in it.
Okay. Thank you. Members, do you have any other questions? Representative Franson.
Ms. Warner. Thank you. Ms. Warner, question for you. As you heard about the issue with the county licensors, what recommendation would rural Minnesota give to us on how to handle this very complex issue?
Madam Chair, it is a very complex issue, and it is it's a complicated issue because it's the issue of almost territories. But I think that the recommendation that was in your bill, which was the one that was included in here, about really examining the training that's being given to county licensors and making sure that that training is consistent for them, that they have a very good understanding of what is expected of them and how they should be treating providers is very important. County licensors are, especially in greater Minnesota, where people are 200 and 300 miles from St. Paul, the county licensor is the first point of contact for the provider with the state, and they are the person that is the explainer and the enforcer of the, not just the enforcer of the regulations, but the explainer of what is going on and why things are the way they are. And I heard enough from people saying things anecdotally like, we feel like we're the criminal and we feel like they're always just looking for something to find. And then, for example, in the in the testimony in one of the committee hearings last fall, providers were saying, well, the county licensor in this county is wonderful to work with, and the county licensor in this other county is terrible to work with. And so I think that lack of consistency and just the emotional factor in it is really whipsawing people around. And so anything that can really increase the professionalism and the consistency of how licensors deal with the providers would be helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Warner, I'm going to refer to the chart, the slide where it says certain groups are harder hit. Mm-hmm. I just have a couple questions. First of which, with low-income households, could you give me a little tighter definition in terms of what that monetarily speaks to in terms of household income?
Certainly. I believe the definition in this particular report was at $20,000 a year.
Madam Chair, Ms. Warner, when you're talking about the next two bullet points on that same chart, talking about children with special needs, I guess I'm trying to find out if it's the spots that aren't available, per se, or the expertise. And I know that there is a correlation between the two, but I'm hoping that you can help explain in terms of what really is the nexus for that bullet point.
Certainly, Madam Chair. I would say it's both. A provider who's going to take to care for a child with special needs needs that special training. Children with special needs that may be a physical handicap, it may be an emotional handicap that requires some kind of specialty training. So you need a provider in the first place who has the knowledge and the ability. It can be physical strength, being able to lift the child and move the child around and be able to handle the child's equipment and things like that. And so that would basically include the spaces, because I think without the provider, you don't have the spaces. And the providers with that kind of special knowledge are few and far between.
No, I'm sure. Thank you. Maybe just to follow on to that, are child care centers regulated in terms of the number of spaces availed to children with handicaps?
Madam Chair, I actually don't know. I don't know that there is a required number. I'm sure there are people here in the audience that could probably answer that question for you.
And just one final question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Ms. Warner, on the chart itself, you're talking about all households, low-income, children with special needs, minority households, from a momentum perspective in terms of the growth of each one of those subgroups. Which one would be the fastest growing, the most alarming to be concerned about, if there was one that, you know, really caught your eye that would be concerning to this panel?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I would say based on the population growth patterns in Greater Minnesota, it would probably be the non-English speaking / immigrant groups. Now, there may be people here who know better on that, but I would say it's probably them just because they are growing. They're the fastest growing group in Greater Minnesota and in many of the counties.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, did you have a question?
Yes, I have a question regarding the regulations again. Because of, I think, our last meeting was so very strong, there were some strong opinions about it. Does the department provide sort of a definition of what this regulation is built around? Do you understand my question? I'm thinking about, you know, for consistency, mm-hmm. that if the department puts out like a definition of what that would entail, that particular regulation, does that happen?
Yeah, Ms. Warner. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the regulations are spelled out fairly clearly in legislation. The legislature sets the regulations, and then the Department of Human Services enforces them. I don't believe there is a whole lot of interpretation left to the Department of Human Services. The regulations are fairly specific. Mm-hmm. The issue that I was hearing about was that there was a base set of regulations, and then in reaction to tragedies that have happened in the last 20 years or so, more regulations were added to address those specifically. Those started conflicting with some of the others, or they started to really add to a lot of the work and paperwork and complication of providing child care. And that was a lot of what I was hearing in the area of regulation in those terms.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or thoughts? Well, I really appreciate your bringing this to us. And if we find that we have more questions, we'll definitely seek you out. And I appreciate your coming up here tonight.
Thank you very much.
I'll also just point out for members in your packets, there's two handouts from the Department of Human Services. One's about licensed child care trends in Minnesota, a fact sheet, and then another one about availability of licensed child care in Minnesota. And I just had them add those.
I think we're now I appear to be on.
All right,
thank you.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cisa Keller, and I'm the Director of Early Childhood Quality Development at Think Small. For those of you that may not know the work of Think Small is a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing quality care and education for children in their crucial years. We do this in three buckets of work. We talk about our work as strengthening families, supporting providers, and catalyzing change. I was asked to come and talk about the work that Think Small is doing around supporting cultural providers. And I just want to talk about our activities in a variety of ways. When we talk about Think Small's work, depending on what we're doing, we may be doing that in the 7-county metro, we may be doing that statewide, we may be doing things nationally and even internationally. As an example of some of our work specifically to cultural providers, we offer over 1,800 trainings in the 7-county metro in fiscal year 16 in 7 different languages. We administer the early learning scholarships both in Region 3 and Northwestern Minnesota, as well as in Region 11. That's the 7-county metro. We also administer the Ramsey County basic sliding fee. We actually own a publishing arm. We run a mission-based publishing arm, and we have over 275 early childhood titles that are in publication right now. And we also operate a statewide library that's an early childhood library. But here, like I said, I'm going to talk about the work that we do in supporting cultural providers and providers of color. We like to talk about this from a strength-based. We think that Minnesota has some of the richest diversity when it comes to family child care providers. In particular, in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, we know that 42% of licensed family child care providers are actually providers of color. And we think that this is a real strength to our community. But we know that we need more, especially as we know that many of the children that are starting kindergarten not yet ready are actually being served by many of these providers, and so we need to offer additional supports. But we do know that with sufficient supports, these providers can both thrive as business owners and as educators. For example, one of the things that is, we were looking at the various numbers, there is certainly, as you guys are seeing, there's a huge shortage. There is a decline in the number of family child care providers across the state. But as we start to compare that with providers of color, we actually see that there's a much less decline in providers of the number of providers of color in the 7-county metro, and more specifically in the areas of Hennepin and Ramsey County, where we actually get additional funding to directly support those providers. And in fact, in Hennepin County, we see almost no decline at all when it comes to providers of color. And we think that this is because of a couple of things that we do with that sufficient or that supplemental funding. One, we are very dedicated in making sure that the workforce that we have with Think Small that's working with providers represents those providers of color. So, for example, our coaches, our quality coaches, whether those are coaches working for Parent Aware, working on social and emotional coaching, nutrition coaching, we have all sorts of coaching models. Those providers are actually represent the community. So we have coaches that are from the Somali community, the Hmong community, the Latino community are in the process of exploring how we can support the Karen community as well. We also operate the language access line for the state. This is a group of individuals that is actually offering both translation as well as interpretation when it comes to supporting both providers and parents. Whether they're looking to find childcare, looking to find trainings, looking to find coaching, any questions they may have, whether it's grants, how to actually access grants that the Department of Human Services supports in startup grants, ongoing continuous improvement grants, our language line is able to support those providers. Through the Race to the Top grant, we actually were able to develop what we call the Bilingual Bicultural Training Project. This was a project in which we actually recruited and trained over 30 trainers to be able to deliver trainings in their home language, and we are able to deliver those trainings now in over 8 different languages. So those include Somali, Hmong, Spanish, Karen, Oromo, Arabic, and I can't think of the rest of them. But we actually, if you come into our facility any given night, you'll probably hear a training that's actually being delivered in the home language. And finally, we just recently ended a 2-year grant with the federal government with the Office of Refugee and Resettlement, where we actually worked with new immigrants that had been in the country for less than 5 years to set up the business of childcare and actually get them not only licensed, but then entering their Parent Aware journey. So we actually successfully licensed 10 different providers, mostly from the Karen community, to be able to serve those children. So what I want to point out is that with sufficient supports, we actually can see that a lot of these providers do very well. In addition to the things that we just did, I want to mention a couple of other things that we're currently working on. The one-time Parent Aware money that you all passed last legislative session, there was $2 million. Half of that money is going to free and reduced training that is being delivered specifically with the focus of trying to serve support providers that are serving low at risk or low-income children. And in the 7-county metro, that is mostly providers of color. So we're administering that and setting out those trainings. In partnership with Generation Next, we're actually working to increase the number of providers of color that are Parent Aware rated at the 3- and 4-star level. Currently, we have about 12% of those providers meet that criteria. We want to increase that to 35% over the next 3 years. And then finally, we're working with First Children's Finance with their business support model, and I know you guys heard from First Children's Finance at the last committee. We're working with them to actually take that really successful model and actually adapt it to the cultural community so that it's relevant for them as well. So in closing, I just want to say that while we do see a shortage across the state, that shortage is applicable as well to the cultural communities, but that we have really good strategies on how to support these communities, and we know what those are. We just need to continue to do those supports. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. And now, members, you do have a copy of the handout I referenced, and it contains a definition of culturally responsive early childhood programs and some language around what does it mean to say culturally specific or culturally responsive. And then on the back, it does have some statistics about languages spoken in child care programs and some of the diversity of programs that we have. Members, do you have any questions for Ms. Keller?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. To the earlier testifier, they talked a lot about in their slide presentation about the difficulty from an economic perspective in making a living at this, whether it be a family child care center or one that's otherwise child care center. So from your perspective, what's making the difference for the organizations that you're supporting in comparison to the testimony we just heard?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So I think for us, I think as a business model, family child care and child care centers is a challenging business model to be able to be successful at, especially many folks come into this business because they really love children, they want to serve children, they want to serve families. They didn't necessarily come with a business background. And so for us, I think what we have done successfully is we have both supported them as early childhood educators, making sure they have the tools, the confidence, the competence to be able to educate those children and support those families to be that child's first teacher. But we're also linking them to the resources to have a really sound business. So that might be things like, are they on the food program where they are able to access additional funds to support some of the nutritious meals that they're able to serve? Are they utilizing child care assistance? Are they in parent aware so that they can benefit from things like increased reimbursement rates with CCAP or eligible for early learning scholarships? So we're very intentional about both supporting that early childhood side as well as that business side. The other example I would use is that First Children's Finance business coaching model. So we're really making sure that they have really good, sound business practices so that they can keep their doors open and potentially thrive as they're serving those children and family, which is why they got into the business in the first place.
Madam Chair, so what I hear you is that the use of governmental programs and the subsidies therein is making up the difference for that which might be of an independent nature where you're not realizing those helps from programs that are assisting low-income families in particular. Would that suggest that those daycare centers would not be able to survive if they didn't have those supports?
Ms. Keller?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright. Yeah, so we talk a lot about in early childhood leveraging and braiding funding streams. So to be successful in this current climate, you do need to have all of those funding streams to be successful. That without any one of those, it is going to be a struggle, especially as we talk about things around child care assistance reimbursement rates. Those are certainly not as high as those need to be able to meet the needs of families. Even early learning scholarships, we know that in certain areas, those do not cover the cost. So you need to have multiple funding streams to be able to cover the true cost of what care is. And if you're not able to access one of those, it can be a challenge to keep your business open.
Representative Aldrin.
Thank you, Madam, for indulging me. I asked a question of the earlier testifier with regard to the rise, particularly with the children who have special needs. And no demographic is immune from that, and I'd appreciate hearing your comments on that with regard to some of the groups that you are working with.
Ms. Keller?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So I think you can talk about whether it's special needs or it's supporting children from a particular culture or supporting children from a particular language. In any one of those instances, what we want to make sure is that those adults in the environment have both the confidence and competence to be able to serve those children. And so, for example, as you talk about special needs children, there is certain qualifications and certain trainings and certain experiences that we want to make sure that those adults in the setting have and funds that they're properly supported. We may want to look at things as far as, you know, are they able to serve the same number of children if they're serving children with special needs, or do we need to have a different, say, reimbursement rate for child care assistance to be able to have a lower ratio so that they're able to serve those children that may require more from them. When it comes to supporting children from culture, from language, we just want to make sure that those adults have those that support behind them to be able to do that. What we're running into now is that there's not quite enough support out there. And as you heard, particularly in greater Minnesota, trying to get to trainings, though we're really addressing a lot of the training issues as far as trying to make sure that those trainings are accessible, but we want to get more trainings for providers in a lot of different platforms, and we're moving very quickly on that as fast as we can. So,
Representative? Okay. Thank you. Senator Johnson?
Ms. Keller, I think it's Keller, isn't it? Yes. In this article, you know, with the rural Minnesota organization put out, they write in here that in a 2009 survey by the Minnesota Department of Human Services found that nearly 60% of people of color said child care provided by a family member was very important, compared to 29% of all households. So 60% of the people of color would prefer family caregiving. Do you know how many licensed family caregivers in Minnesota?
Ms. Keller?
Representative Wicklund.
Or maybe Hennepin County. That would
absolutely. So I can tell you that currently in I'm just looking at my chart here really quick. So the number of licensed family child care providers in the 7-county metro, there's 3,336. And Hennepin County, there's 884. I think those were the two numbers that you asked for. I would like to so that particular child care use study, part of that is also when they say family child care providers, they also are referencing what we call family, friend, and neighbor care. And so for many providers, they're looking for somebody that is not necessarily a licensed provider. We see this particularly in some of the cultural communities where this is very, very important for them. And we are continuing to look for opportunities to support those communities. Our number one priority is always to find a pathway to licensure. We do believe that licensure is so very important to make sure that those basic health and safety requirements are being met. Mm-hmm. But for some providers, a pathway for licensure is not an option for a variety of legal reasons, whether that's immigration, things of that nature. And so in those instances, we are continuing to look for opportunities to support those providers that we know are caring for children in potentially, and we know, sometimes in very high-quality means. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Johnson.
So you're saying that you would provide assistance to people who were not licensed but were caring for children. Is that correct?
Ms. Keller.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, so we do have the opportunity to actually support those what we call legally non-licensed and friends, family, and neighbor care. Those providers are eligible. We do have actually a pot of money to be able to support those providers with free and reduced training. So we are able to support them. So like I say, our number one goal is to get them licensed, but we are able to support them if that is not an option.
And again,
Senator
Madam
Johnson.
Chair, thank you. So outstate Minnesota would not be impacted by Think Small.
Ms. Keller.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, with regards to training and coaching, Think Small does not offer any training and coaching in greater Minnesota. There are other entities similar to Think Small throughout the state. They're part of the Child Care Aware of Minnesota system. And actually, several of my coordinators are here today from greater Minnesota, and so they would be able to talk specifically about the work they're doing in greater Minnesota.
And Ms. Keller, I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I really, because I believe that many people would look at Think Small and try to pattern and get help from you. I know that, but I meant literally doing it. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And we will be talking more about that, providing a training across the state and who is providing it a little bit later in the meeting, too. So, any other questions for Ms. Keller? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we've kind of touched the subject, but there's probably a lot more to be said and talked about. How do we continue to encourage and grow the child care provider business in the culturally appropriate areas? So, thank you. And then moving to one thing that we heard in the presentation earlier was that perhaps we need to find out more about why providers are leaving the field. Actually, maybe that I'm thinking about the training requirements. But if we consider options for exit interviews with providers who leave the child care field or choose not to be relicensed, we have a representative from MACSA here to talk a little bit about that. And I'm sorry, I don't know exactly who to call forward. There were two names I was given, and if you're both going to talk about it, that's great. I think I have Liz Dodge and Commissioner Tony Carter.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. As you said, I am Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner. I am here also with Liz Dodge, who is from Chisago County. And I'm here specifically on behalf of our counties and the Association of Minnesota Counties. We are both here to say that counties care very deeply about this issue. We're fully committed to the health and the safety and, of course, the development of our very youngest citizens, our children. Counties are invested in the success of young children, of families, and providers in our community because a system that works well for all of us and meets everyone's need is an important aspect of supporting vibrant communities. And that is what we are here to do for throughout our state. So you know that counties fulfill many of the state's family child care licensing and also management of child care assistance. And we do that with a mix of funding that includes our local property taxpayer dollars. We use the funds to supplement state funding in provider training and in financial support for our families. And we do welcome technical suggestions on improving the system, but would also like to take the opportunity to remind us all that while we are focused on the cost of care, the overarching issue that we are dealing with really is the underfunding of our entire child and early childhood development system. So short of full funding by the state of many of the recommendations that have been discussed to date, these recommendations, if implemented, would actually place additional unfunded burden on counties and on our priority of supporting and caring for children and families and for the entire system, including our providers. This includes the regulatory functions, the training for providers and for staff, and also supporting and assisting families who have difficulty covering the high cost of high quality care for young children and families that cannot afford the cost. So simply to repeat, counties are committed to continuous improvement of our system and in meeting our responsibilities. And while it is true that these are needed, unfortunately, they are also unlikely to reduce the cost to families. So we're hopeful that beyond important issues of provider regulation, the committee will focus its greatest attention on how to increase the resources to help our young families pay for and afford the true cost of child care.
Ms. Dodge?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Liz Dodge. I'm the Social Service Director in Chisago County. Chisago County is just a little bit north of the metro area, but we are considered one of the non-metro counties. I'm here on behalf of MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. Regarding the issue of exit interviews, we think these might provide good information, but asking county staff to do this may not result in the most honest answers that you're seeking. As an alternative, the legislature may want to provide DHS with the resources to hire a professional to do a one-time survey of providers who have left during a period of time that would be of interest, perhaps the past 2 years. That person could also review the licensor closing case notes, which are often placed in our social service information system, to cross-check what they hear. This could result in a thorough report to the legislature for further action. Counties share the legislature's concern about providers leaving the system. In Chisago County alone, we've seen a 25% reduction in licensed family child care in the past 5 years. So I'd like to make 4 points, if I may. Point one, what we found, at least anecdotally in recent years, is that many provider closings have been due to age-appropriate and age-related requirements or retirements. These are providers who have done the work for quite some time and have earned their rest. One of the Hennepin County licensors reviewed his caseload recently and determined that one-third of his 150 providers had either already informed him that they were retiring soon or would be as soon as they were eligible for Social Security or Medicare. In Chisago County, as well as other counties, but I know my county the best, we have heard about providers retiring or otherwise leaving because of housing costs, mortgage crisis, young families and children who age out, family illnesses, the need to care for aging parents, returning to school, as well as the ability to earn higher incomes with other jobs. Hennepin County is considering an online or otherwise easily accessible survey instrument for providers leaving the system to supplement what they know anecdotally. Our second point, counties have found that those providers who have true challenges meeting the safety rules will withdraw rather than face a more stern negative action against them. We see this as a good thing because it helps keep children from harm. Our third point, counties, both those in greater Minnesota and in the metro, regularly do have new applications. The metro area has reported that they've seen a large number of those applicants being either former child care center staff who want to run their own business or folks from immigrant communities who want to serve their neighbors. And finally, as it relates to point four, the state becomes more diverse, especially families with young children, counties will need to find new ways to support culturally specific providers. Some counties, like Hennepin, are already fortunate in that they have some staff who speak other languages. They have also used property tax dollars to help fund interpreters who can help applicants who speak languages other than English navigate the applicant support county workers provide. Please understand that we in the counties are trying to do our best with limited resources. On behalf of Minnesota's 87 counties, I would request that if the legislature chooses to move forward with a requirement that counties conduct interviews with providers exiting the system, that it attempt to fully fund that requirement. We would like to avoid unfunded county mandates.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions? Thank you. I will take that into consideration if we feel, I'm glad to know that you think it would provide some interesting and useful information, but I can understand the limitations of what could be collected. So, but thank you for bringing that information to us. Next, we'll move to, I put them together under an item, reviewing child care provider retention and support strategies, and it's certainly not all strategies that would be possible, but it was several of the items that we had in our work plan. One was to consider creation of a board of child care to be responsible for all matters related to licensing of child care providers, both in-home and center-based. Another was, as was mentioned earlier, consider uniform training requirements for county employees and their supervisors. And then some brief discussion about career pathways and workforce development opportunities that could help encourage more people to go into the business, as well as supporting them while they are providers. So first we have a presentation by the department. Deb Swenson-Klatt and Reggie Wagner will present. And are you able to locate your presentation? Do you know how to get it turned on? And members, we do have a copy of the presentation. Okay. It's this one with the blue slides.
Yeah, great.
I guess it takes a while for that projector to turn on up there. So I think you can start.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Reggie Wagner, I'm with the Department of Human Services, the Licensing Division.
But that microphone doesn't sound like it's on, so.
Madam Chair, is that Reggie Wagner?
There.
DHS, all Licensing right. Division. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very briefly, my slides are kind of high level. I'd like to move a little bit quickly through to just provide you with some information on recommendations. And so as Senator Wicklund said, one of the recommendations for the task force to consider was the creation of a board of child care specific around licensing issues. And I guess what we would point out is that there currently does not exist that body with that particular function related to licensing activities, either for centers or families. Minnesota does have what's called the Minnesota Early Learning Council that is part of a federal grant program for the development of high-quality early childhood education systems. But it has the Minnesota Children's Cabinet, which is a coordination of policies and programs and resources to support and improve outcomes for Minnesota's children. However, they do not specifically focus in on child care or are limited solely to child care. And it appeared the intent of the recommendation for the task force was to consider something related specifically to child care. What we would say is that as we have looked at that and looked at what other states have. There certainly are other states that have created a very formal child care advisory council that has a couple of different models to it. We've just given you in your slides a few places to consider. They have various structures and sizes and compositions and often do include both licensed center and licensed family providers. For example, the charge to the Child Care Advisory Council in Nevada talks about making recommendations about the industry related to educational strategies for providers, revision of regulations, complaint processes, fine fee methodologies, other issues affecting child care facilities. Maine was another one that we called out as a little bit different, maybe a little bit broader charge. They have a subcommittee that is exclusively looking at reviewing licensing and recommending uniform regulatory system for family daycare homes. So we certainly think that there are models out there. If the committee goes in that direction, then we would certainly be looking to kind of see what might make sense. Obviously, the other charge, looking at the uniform training requirement, that certainly could be a topic in whole or in part for the Child Care Advisory Council if that, in fact, is something that emerges and goes forward. We do provide training across. We gave you the list of trainers. I think what might be helpful for some context, prior to 2013, our family system, our county delegated, where the counties do the licensing work and make recommendations to the commissioner for approval or denial of licenses for temporary immediate suspensions that might immediately shut a provider down, for conditionals or revocations. Those are all licensing activities in addition to the ongoing compliance and monitoring that the county does. But those specific ones I called out our recommendations, and our office is very involved in making those decisions with the county. Often we accept the recommendation of the county, but we're not required to, and if we see a need to go a little bit deeper, we might. So prior to 2013, we had five licensing specialists, just a generic term for them because they're not the actual licensors that go out into the homes, that were overseeing over 16,000 licenses across the state that are licensed in our county delegated system. And that would have included, at that time, probably about 12,000 family child care licensed providers, but it also includes child foster care. And adult foster care that are licensed at the county level. In 2013, we did get some additional resources from the legislature. We did increase our staff complement by 2, and were able to focus on training specific to some of the new safe sleep legislation that had come out. But I think we think it's helpful as we talk about, increased training requirements, what our kind of capacity is, that currently there are 9,200 licensed family child care providers across the state. There are approximately 130 county licensers who oversee that and do that licensing activity, and then we oversee the county as part of our delegated system. If I could, Senator Wicklund, my last comment, Representative Albright, you asked a few questions. One particular was whether there is any requirement that might limit or speak to licensed care and children with special needs. There is nothing that either limits or caps or prevents a provider from doing that. They clearly would need to be, as I think the other testifiers have spoken to, looking at the requirements of who they are serving and how they can ensure that they can do the appropriate development and guidance for that child, as well as the other supervising of the other children that are in their care. So there isn't anything that would prevent a limit or anything in that area.
Before we move forward, do members have any questions about either this idea of a child care board or council that could address some of the concerns that we've heard? Any questions about that? I know this is really high level at this stage, but we could have some additional information provided about Nevada and Maine if that's of interest to members. Okay. And then maybe we could tailor if we want to make a recommendation about moving forward with that as a proposal. We can. Do you have a comment? Or Representative Franson?
Well, Senator Wicklund, I was just wondering if that is something that NCSL can assist with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that they could. I reached out to them last week just with some general questions about child care, and they do have a group in Denver that works on child and youth issues, and they would be happy to look into other items further, so I could ask them to look into this.
Yeah, I went through their fellowship program on that as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. If not, any other questions about the board? Or it sounds like with training options for county licensors, it sounds like definitely need to look at the capacity to add this training, both from DHS standpoint and the county standpoint, mm-hmm. if they're going to be required to do more training. Representative Franson?
Yes, one more thing on Senator Wicklund. I just want to say, too, that the board that I'm kind of envisioning in my head would be separate from DHS, like its mm-hmm. own separate board, mm-hmm. so that the providers would have their, they could go to a different just a different board, so that it's not tied with DHS, and they could just have an independent review of how things look and listen to them from an independent mm-hmm. view as well.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Now moving to, you wanted to briefly talk about the career pathways and workforce development.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deb Swenson-Clad. I'm the manager of Child Development Services at the Department of Human Services.
Can you hold
a little closer?
Yeah.
Okay. Our unit at DHS supports services and provides services to improve the availability and the quality of child care programs in Minnesota. And we do this through grants to state and local organizations that help families find quality child care options.
It's still really quiet, so we can't hear you very well.
All right.
I'll move even closer better. And I'll speak up more. Yeah. Thank you. I know I have a yes. So our unit helps families find quality child care options, and we help child care and early childhood programs improve their quality, ultimately helping children access higher quality programs. Today, just briefly, I'll share some information with you first about career pathways and the development of the child care workforce. So just to set the stage, here is some information about the number of people in the child care workforce in Minnesota. We estimate that about 40,000 people work in this industry, and around 10,000 in Head Start and school-based settings, with over 35,000, the vast majority, working in licensed child care settings. As you heard in the last hearing of this task force, the estimated 35,000 members of the workforce work in over 1,600 child care centers across the state, and as Ms. Wagner just said, over 9,000 family child care homes. A 2011 DHS study of the child care workforce highlighted the many ways in which the workforce is very diverse with regard to the settings in which individuals work, including for-profit and nonprofit child care centers, and of course, family child care homes, in all parts of Minnesota, rural, suburban, and urban, with a wide range of experience and education levels, as well as a workforce that speaks different languages and represents many different cultural backgrounds. Given the child care shortages we may be facing, we need to grow the size of this workforce and ensure that the workforce is qualified, particularly in Greater Minnesota, and in part by providing supports to those who are entering and staying in the child care field. These supports need to be responsive to the diversity of the individuals in these settings and also, importantly, to the stressors that they face, including long hours and low pay. We also need to recognize the importance of and the reality that this workforce often moves among programs, from a child care center to a school-based pre-K program or a Head Start program or a child care center to starting their own family child care business. Providing a pathway to degrees and credentials is one important way to support the entire workforce of adults working with young children. And state and national research tells us that when providers and the child care teachers have professional preparation combined with ongoing training and support, then they're more likely to engage effectively with children. The learning environments are safer and of higher quality, and children have more positive child outcomes. In Minnesota, an individual in the child care workforce can enter at any point along this pathway, starting with non-credit-based training, earning a non-credit-based child development associate credential, articulating these non-credit-based trainings to credits, and or pursuing a higher education degree or credential. DHS, with our partners in the child care aware system and in institutions of higher ed, work to make sure that this pathway is as accessible as we can, make it for everyone, including recognizing that having or working towards a degree or credential can contribute to a higher quality rating in parent aware. Members of the child care workforce can move along the career pathway, accessing needed training and improving education with the support of, for instance, professional development advisors who are in place in our child care aware system to help providers assess their training and education needs and set goals. Another example of supports is our scholarships to help defray the cost of non-credit-based and higher education degrees. Coaching and consultation, as Cisa Keller mentioned, are available along with grants to child care programs to help providers improve their quality. And financing supports are available for higher quality by paying higher rates through the Child Care Assistance Program and through scholarships when programs are of higher quality. And by encouraging, importantly, programs to partner with Head Start in their communities around the state. Over the past 5 years, DHS has been able to offer more of these services than in the past with funding from Minnesota's Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant. These funds do end this December 2016, reducing the number of programs we'll be able to serve with these supports. And if more funding were available, we could offer more services. This final slide on the workforce shows how the Race to the Top funding helped provide education credentials to more providers while greatly, again, deferring the cost of these educational opportunities. The graph shows that the number of credentials awarded each year increased from about 230 in 2011 before the Race to the Top grant to over 500 awarded in 2015. At this point in time, this task force may be interested in knowing that two state-level early childhood workforce work groups are underway in Minnesota, each involving a wide range of stakeholders from multiple state agencies, higher education, and provider associations. The National Governor Association's work group on workforce compensation is examining methods to increase compensation for the early childhood workforce with the goal of developing recommendations that could be brought to either the 2017 or 2018 legislative session. And then a National Academy of Sciences work group is underway. The National Academy of Sciences has issued a significant report, national report called Transforming the Workforce, and this is specific to the early childhood workforce, with 13 recommendations, and the Minnesota work group is a part of a work group with other states looking at state-specific recommendations, and their recommendations are due out next summer.
Great. Thank you very much. Do members have any questions about Ms. Swenson-Klotz's testimony? Representative Albright?
Thank you. I'm going to refer to your last slide that you talked about with the Career Pathways Workforce Development Services. And I will preface my questions by being very blunt that I don't know much about daycare other than that I'm concerned about the health and welfare of kids. Mm-hmm. But from a businessman's perspective, business person's perspective, can you help me understand how increasing their education correlates with a change to the positive in their profit and loss statement? Because it seems to me like you're giving them greater credentials. Mm-hmm. That's great. They may want to stay. But at the end of the day, if your P&L doesn't show a positive number on the bottom line above the double bar, you're not going to stay in business. And so what do these programs really have to do with, other than understandably providing a better experience for the child themselves, what happens to the P&L when your wage bonuses and increased education actually, in a sense, deter the child care owner from earning a profit because they're having to pay higher wages to keep those people at their center? Can you explain that?
Ms. Swenson-Klotz.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think this is a conundrum that states across the country are wrestling with and have wrestled with for many, many years. That Transforming the Workforce report that I mentioned is indeed one of a number of efforts to try to put in front of state policymakers both strategies to address the compensation and, as you say, profit and loss issues alongside the real value of higher education for this workforce in order to provide high-quality services. I can tell you that these supports that we have been offering do indeed defray some of the cost of earning those educational credentials, and we believe go a long way towards improving the quality. Over time, I think we're going to need to wrestle with the compensation issues that continue to go forward with any business that's trying to be successful. And Ms. Keller's references to the coaching and the consultation around business supports such that a business owner, a family child care provider, or a center director can fully take advantage of the funding streams that are in place, along with ensuring that the educational opportunities are being nurtured for the young children in their care.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
This is a little bit of an op-ed here, but if we're always relying upon revenue streams that supplant the income that would be generated by the users, and I understand we're dealing with a very disparate group of people that are using the service, so I understand that. But at the end of the day, if the manna stops falling from heaven because of the volatility of either a federal or a state program, you've got child care providers that are going to go out of business because they aren't generating a level of income to support themselves, irrespective of what they're receiving from these other streams of income. And so to the point earlier made by the presenter about business development and looking at a P&L, education and the quality experience only gets you so far. It makes you feel good, but it doesn't pay the bills. It doesn't keep the lights on in the child care center. And so when you say that we're going to have to start or look to wrestle with this, I think that time's right now. Mm-hmm. It's not in the future. We're losing child care providers now, not in the future. And to suggest that we're going to take it up later, I thought that's what the purpose of the task force was, is to bring recommendations forward. And with all respect, I think that is the point, is how we're going to keep these people in business. Because if they don't stay in business, independent of government expenditures or funding or revenue streams, however you want to call it, we will not have a quality child care experience for anyone. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I do hope that, you know, we are looking at this from the standpoint of what we can do short-term and long-term, and some of the things maybe short-term we can start to address, but some are going to be longer-term, are going to require a longer-term effort, and that's going to be required from, you know, not only us looking at it from a government perspective, but also how does business partner with, they need employees to be able to come to work, and, you know, how do we also take advantage of opportunities to partner with businesses, because it is essential for them to have employees available. Representative Franson, did you have a...
Senator Wicklin, so to bring this back to family home providers, because we touched on education with centers, I'll just use myself for example. When I graduated with a bachelor's in psychology, took some early childhood classes, minored in humanities, don't ask me why. Now, what I charged for childcare was nowhere out of the realm in my area, even with a bachelor's. I could have gone, you know, I could get a master's in early childhood, but I still, even with that master's, would be unable to raise my rates because I'm going to get outpriced. I can't outprice everything else, right? Everyone else in the area. So even with education, though, we're still going to be unable to raise our income. Plus, then we're going to have the debt from our loans and education costs. Because in family home childcare, where are we going to find scholarships to, because you're a private sector, you're your own business, unless there's some foundational grants in order to help offset that. But you're still not going to be able to raise your costs to better your income.
Ms. Swanson-Klein, do you have a, I don't know, is there a question?
No, I'm just kind of I mean, what do you say to that?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Franson, I would say that the supports that we offer and are highlighted in this slide are absolutely available for family child care providers as well as child care center staff. So indeed, a TEACH scholarship for degrees or credentials is available to family child care providers, and it is our a significant effort that we're making in Minnesota and have had in place for a long time to support providers who are on a path towards pursuing a degree.
Senator Johnson.
And it's really a comment. It's not a question. If you have some remarks, I would appreciate that. But it seems to me that we're really in a kind of a new age. And It's one that I can recall very long time ago when I was first elected in the Minnesota House in 1986. And one of the first bills I carried was elementary teacher preparation time. Because at that time, elementary teachers, they don't do anything. You know, anybody can teach a first grader or kindergarten. But that was my first understanding of how important what happens in the early years is. I did not know that. I will admit that. I think I did a pretty good job without knowing it, but I would have done better if I had known it. But when the teachers came in and said that they can tell by, you know, in first or second grade, they can tell who's going to be a dropout with almost 100% accuracy. And my response was, well, why don't we take care of that? It costs a lot of money because we know that people who drop out of school spend, a lot of them spend time in prison. And they're in the juvenile system and so forth. And costly, costly, costly. Well, okay, we're now in a new spot. And I read in here, they say that from birth to age 3, a baby's brain makes up to 700 neuron connections a minute. And we all hear it now that say, you know, what happens in those first 3 years is probably the most important education of a child's life in terms of success. And so how do we do that? It's a major issue because the people who are lower income, and we all know that, and there's nothing wrong with having a low income if you can live with what you need. But they're the ones that are having more children than people with higher incomes. That's statistics. And they are often required. I mean, they have to work, and they probably earn, you know, $12, $15 an hour, maybe. And then the percentages of how much of their income goes to child care, if they have child care, or they will be staying home or staying with a grandma or auntie or whoever it might be. So it is a major problem, and it's a very much of a money problem. It could become in the future that maybe we'll look upon the early years as a school, part of school, and that parents who are taking care of their children get subsidized and parents who put them in child care get subsidized too because it's so important for all of us because that's the future of our country and our state of Minnesota for sure. But anyway, so I make that comment. It's not easy, but we cannot not address money. And that is an issue for the legislature.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I think your own experience and the research that you cite is the reason why DHS has driven much of its the resources that we have available towards workforce supports and in particular the supports for earning education, receiving both training and education. And I would say that we do indeed feel that the issue is of great urgency and look forward to continued conversation with this committee now.
Thank you. I had on the agenda also that MACSA would provide additional information on this topic. Is that the case? Do you have, okay, why don't you come forward? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Franson. Sorry. Did you have?
Yeah, so I do have a question for DHS before we have. So I just want to quickly go back to that slide on. Oh, gosh, I got to find it here. Hold on a second. Oh, training options for county licensors. How does a complaint become a negative action?
And my question is, how many times has DHS not accepted the recommendation of the county regarding a revocation or suspension? And can you give some examples? So the perception is that when there is an issue that that recommendation is not accepted.
Ms. Wagner, did you wish to address that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will ask Mary Kelsey. She's our manager who oversees our family system, our county delegated area. I can say that part at the core of that, as I mentioned, is that there are recommendations that the county makes to the department, and the department is not bound by those, and we certainly do in various circumstances come to a different decision than what the county does. And Mary can certainly talk a little bit about a few instances where that might be. I don't know that we have any ready data for you as to how that is. We can go back and sort of check on that and see what we can provide you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Reggie's correct that we don't have data at hand, but we could look and see what we could provide.
Say your name for the record when you...
Pardon me? Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm new at this. Mary Kelsey with DHS Licensing.
Thank you.
I'm the manager of our family systems area. As far as whether, you know, we always accept what the county recommends, no, in fact, we don't. And some examples, there was one just in the past week where a county had recommended revocation of a license, but based on our review of the recommendation, there wasn't the nature, severity, or chronicity.
Can you speak just a little closer to the microphone and then?
Oh, sure. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay, so I was saying within the past week, even we had a recommendation for revocation of a license. But based on our review of the record, the nature and chronicity and seriousness of the licensing violations didn't warrant a revocation. Our role with reviewing the negative action recommendations is to ensure the consistency around the state. And so there are certainly times that we receive a recommendations for a certain type of sanction, but we don't issue it. Occasionally we receive a recommendation for a fine, for example, for an infant sleep violation. But if on our review of the record and asking some further questions, there wasn't a sleep violation, we don't issue the fine.
Representative Franson, you had a question about the specific nature of that, example?
Yes. Could you give an example of what the county had recommended? What was the violation that was recommended for revocation?
I don't remember all of what was involved, but I believe that there were some safe sleep violations, but they weren't chronic. There wasn't a long pattern. It was something that had occurred in the past 1 or 2 years, which in other cases we would normally issue a conditional license, and that's what we're issuing in this case.
Representative Franson?
And then was that situation able to be used then as a teaching moment for that provider so that she would not or he would not do that violation again?
Well, certainly a conditional license, that's the purpose of it.
Yeah.
And so what happens with a conditional license is the provider gets some terms that they have to comply with. So, for example, submitting a written plan for how they'll safely sleep infants, completing some additional training, those kinds of things. And the terms that we require are standard, too, based on what the type of situation is that's happened.
Representative Franson?
And then also for that specific licensor, was there some coaching done on this situation? So if something came up again in the future that she wasn't requesting another provider be revoked?
You're speaking from the standpoint of training or
yep.
feedback to the person, the licensor, who made the first conditional or the complaint.
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, when we have a situation like that where we don't agree with what's been recommended, we do discuss that with the county and in a coaching kind of manner to explain why we're thinking a different sanction is appropriate. And so every time that that happens, we do discuss that with the county and expect that in the future then that they would apply that experience to the future situation that they're dealing with.
Representative Franzen.
And then one more final thing that I need to get on the record here, and Laura is going to be handing out a sheet here. But what I have here is a picture of a dog dish of water, and there is a joke on there that says, danger, open water, because providers are being written up across the state of Minnesota for having a dog dish of water to water their pet in their home, being claimed that it is a body of water, and it is very dangerous for that child or children, and they could drown in this pet dish. And so they are being written up. And is this something that DHS then will look at and say, hey, this is not what was intended with the statute, with the body of water, and there is nowhere in family child care rules or statutes about pet dishes?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, we've recently heard from a provider on this issue, and we are looking into the situation. We understand that the provider is planning to request reconsideration of her correction order, and so it will be reviewed independently by our legal department, the situation there and whether it was appropriately cited. We haven't seen the correction order yet, so we don't know what actually was cited, but we have heard from the provider, and we're aware of the issue, and we will be addressing it. We can let you know what is the outcome of that.
Representative Franzen.
Do you think, though, that the statute includes pet dishes?
Ms. Kelsey.
I believe that there is some reference in the rule to pet dishes in relation to food preparation areas. There isn't specific discussion in the rule where it talks about bodies of water, though, that it would include pet dishes.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
From Cambridge, or the Chisago County, Liz Dodge. Did you have?
Yes, we were going to have them come forward. I think you had additional information about the board of either feedback on creation of a board of child care or the training requirements, uniform training requirements.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Liz Dodge again from Chisago County, and I'm going to speak both to the creation of a board for child care as well as the uniform licensing discussion, and Commissioner Carter will summarize a little bit from the Association of Minnesota Counties perspective. So, Madam Chair and members, I want to first say, that the counties have a long history of collaborating and involved in partnership arrangements with various parts of our program. In Chisago County, we had a child care advisory committee made up of providers that we would meet with on a regular basis and solicit their perspective as an advisory component to some of our local actions. And that actually was a very productive and engaging process for us. That's one example of how we do it. But I do want to say currently licensing of family child care is a DHS function that is delegated to counties. Counties take our direction from the Department of Human Services. According to statute and rule, counties administer the system that DHS oversees. Accordingly, counties, not the state, carry the legal liability. So counties have significant concern with proposals to subject our part of the system to yet another governing body. If such a board is contemplated, we are asking that it must be to advise the Department of Human Services, not the counties. DHS can synthesize these perspectives from the board and amend its direction to counties on a uniform basis. Counties need directives from DHS for this, for clarity. Everyone benefits when the lines of authority and responsibility are clear and transparent. That would be my comments on the issue of the board. I wanted to comment also on the uniform training requirements for county employees and their supervisors. As the department testified, the state currently offers uniform training to county workers and is collaborating with us on ways to expand and improve those offerings. Department provides the licensing 101 and 201 to new licensors and new supervisors so that we're grounded in law and rule. Seasoned staff are required to take 6 hours of training per year. Many fulfill this at a fall conference, fall licensing conference. Many county workers will also participate in additional training that's relevant to child development. If more standard training is deemed necessary, direction from DHS and uniformity of content seems a very good thing. I would ask you to remember that county staff do the licensing of family-based care, and in many counties, that's one hat they wear amongst many other hats. Many counties have licensing workers that are not dedicated solely to child care licensing. We don't have the capacity or resources to do that. Regardless of county size, added training requirements require another expense of staff time and training resources that counties pay for with property taxes.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm Commissioner Tony Carter from Ramsey County, and I wanted to just add a little bit. I know that counties are in, as you might imagine, a difficult position, and certainly there is a necessary conflict between much of the work that is done, whether it be for licensing or for compliance. Another very important part of the work that we do is customer satisfaction, or I should say provider satisfaction in this case. So we're really rounding out quite a bit of work. And where training is concerned, we are finding that sometimes really good two-way communication can make an incredible difference. In Ramsey County, for example, about a year and a half ago, we had some older, or I should say more mature staff leaving our county, and we were bringing in a number of newer staff into our child care roles. And we heard from a group of our providers that they felt there was a different experience that they were having with the interpretation, perhaps, of some of the requirements. And they were wondering if they were requests or recommendations or requirements coming forward. We did find it necessary, too, and we invested quite a bit of time in reviewing the DHS website and working with DHS to ensure that we were focusing on DHS requirements. And so together with our staff and management, we began to meet with our providers and just listening sometimes and really understanding the issues in advance, hopefully, and sometimes in debrief, really has helped us to make sure we're focusing on those requirements that DHS says and that we are communicating with our providers and they with us. So we do have some difficulty from time to time trying to decide which parts of our system, our child care and our child development system, to fund with our taxpayer dollars. We're in an unenviable position, certainly, where that's concerned, because our children deserve all of the support that they require. The good news is that we do have providers who are willing to work with us in that regard, and we find that if we support them, and they do deserve the support and encouragement and help to equip them, they will stay with us. So I talked about what's happening in Ramsey, a little bit about Hennepin County. You have a copy of a flyer, and we have other copies at the back. Hennepin County is actually investing and targeting their limited budget toward training providers. And the training focuses both on licensing and on Parent Aware, which is a statewide quality rating system for all providers, whether they are family, home-based, or if they are center-based. Hennepin's greatest needs are in serving families of color, so they are laser-focused on working with those providers in this training. We think that they are right on track, and we are looking forward to learning from their experiences and from their results. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, counties are working collaboratively with DHS and with our providers on training. And what we would like is support to continue that work and to help our providers offer the very best care that they can for all of the children in our counties. We welcome every opportunity to do so with you in the future.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would be for Ms. Dodge. Historically, you probably track the data in terms of what the, say, the top five most prevalent, you call them citations. I would probably call them corrective action requests. Could you cite those for me?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I can cite what I think they might be. I don't have the exact data in front of me. We know that safe sleep has become one of the top five. We also have supervision issues, capacity, numbers of care. Those are three that I can think of off the top of my head.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
And from seeking a higher level of excellence, does the training go towards not only addressing those three? So it becomes, as I heard the commissioner speak, it becomes more of a culture of, rather than being cited for infractions in the code, you turn to a partnership with these providers where that you're collaborating and you're trying to help them raise the bar of excellence for themselves. And I hope you understand where I'm coming from. But it would seem that if you've cited those three, have those three changed in the last 10 years from something different, or have they remained the same?
Ms. Dodge.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I can't speak exactly to how they've changed in the past 10 years. What I can tell you is that we have an increased clarity towards what the department's interpretation of the rules and statutes have been through the use of some of the mandatory training and the expectation of trainers that are becoming more consistently applied across the state. And therefore, we hope that the messaging is more consistently used. I can tell you that it is a fine balance for those who regulate the industry to also support and empower those who are in the provision of the service. And I think, speaking from my experience, we do our very best to do both. But there is a time where we have to step off of the support part and use enforcement mechanisms. And that becomes a challenge for individual licensing workers. And the department supports us a great deal in those efforts, as do our various regional partnerships with the Child Care Aware and other systems. So that's what I can tell you about that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In earlier testimony, I heard where the Department of Human Services overruled the revocation of a license by the county. How often does that happen?
Ms. Dodge.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, it happens on occasion. And on occasion, we recommend, there are times where they recommend action when we didn't necessarily recommend the same action. So I think that it happens on occasion. It's not a frequent occurrence.
And would that be, thank you, Madam Chair, and would that be because of, as you said, the gray area between compliance and support, or is it an interpretation of the code that's brought to the county? In your own words, you're implementing rules that are promulgated by the DHS. It seems to me like not only is there training necessary between the providers and the county, but there's certainly sounds like there might be an additional affirmed training in terms of interpretation of the codes between the county and DHS. Would that be something that you would support?
Ms. Dodge.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I would support affirmed and consistent training between the department and the counties at any time. I would also highlight that all of our counties have unique county attorneys and legal representation that support our litigation. And that is where we see, in my experience, we've seen differences coming from our local attorney legal input versus the discussion with the departments, and that becomes a legal discussion that happens.
So you brought up something right now that I had not heard before, but to the point that the county attorneys, are they coordinating the understanding of the implementation of these rules with DHS, or is it up to the department in the county to carry out those objectives? I'm curious. All of a sudden, now we've got the county attorneys involved, and that's a curiosity that I've not heard before.
Commissioner Carter, did you have a...
I just wanted to say that it is really very important that we recognize we're participating underneath DHS's direction and implementing to the greatest extent possible what might be called the letter of the law. So we are playing a role with our providers in managing that compliance. We want to be as clear as possible with our providers that we are interpreting to the very best of our ability, and yes, sometimes with consultation from our county attorney, the commandment of DHS. When there is a need for a negative action in Ramsey County, we are ensuring that that action is reviewed consistently by management before it is approved and can be taken. And we're also making certain that our providers understand with transparency why we are taking this action and encouraging that should they disagree, they do appeal. And so from time to time, there will be a difference in action. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to ask, do you have a question? Okay.
Quick question.
We kind of need to move forward on the agenda, but Representative Franson.
Thank you, Senator Wicklund. So my question to the two of you, first off, thank you for the job that you do. It's very time-consuming, can be very difficult and stressful, I'm sure. My question to you is, discussing this dog dish here, is this something that you've encountered? Do you write up citations, correction orders for providers for watering, having a watering dish for their pet?
And so as a commissioner in Ramsey County, I can assure you that I do not know the detail of what is in the DHS manual that talks about negative actions. And I am not familiar with this.
Ms. Wagner, or you came to the table. Did you have a comment or response that you...
Madam Chair, and...
Okay, well, I don't know if she doesn't have the information, but... Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Dodge, did you have something to add?
Madam Chair, Representative... Well, Madam Co-Chair, you asked the question if we would review such a thing. What I can tell you is that when my licensing worker writes a correction order that a provider would disagree with, the provider may contact me or will request a review at an upper administrative level, and we will review the rules, we will review the statute, we review all those things and do the same thing that Commissioner Carter stated happens in Ramsey County, encourage them to seek another seek their appeal rights or reconsideration rights. So that's what I can tell. I have not encountered that exact example.
Answer your question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just very briefly, Representative Albright, when you mentioned about the role of the county attorney, just as the county, under our delegated licensing system, just as the county licensors are carrying out a function of the commissioner subject to our recommendation and final approval, so are the county attorneys representing the commissioner in those legal actions. For child care centers, if there is an appeal that is going forward, the Attorney General's office would be representing the commissioner in those. And so the county attorney plays that role. We have staff that work very closely with the county attorneys, again, because of that consistency that we are striving. We do continuing legal educations related to our laws. We have a county outreach program. We try to ensure that the county attorneys and the county licensor are as well-equipped and understand the law and understand what the commissioner's decision is as they go forward. So I feel that there is a great amount of coordination that happens both at that licensor level as well as in any appeals that are going forward, and the county attorney does play the role representing the commissioner in those actions.
Thank you. Any other questions for this segment? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Seeing that we are running out of time, I'm going to make a choice here. We have a presentation that Deb Swenson-Klatt was going to continue on training and go into detail about training for providers and the parent aware system and how the training is delivered. We also have three people who have traveled to come here tonight to present on their training delivery models, and I would like to suggest that we have the three of them provide the information about their what they're doing in their communities, so we make sure we get through that. Plus, we have people who would like to testify from the public, and we could perhaps have Deb Swenson-Klatt give the training presentation at a future meeting. I know our future meeting is very full as well, but if that's agreeable, I would prefer to have the people who've traveled here do their presentation on their particular model. Any concerns about that or questions?
Sounds good.
Okay. So we will move on. In terms of training, I wanted to have a variety of providers come forward to tell us a little bit about what they're doing in their communities. And I've got representation from Bloomington, Rochester, and Pine County. And maybe you can all come up and to the table, the three of you, and talk about and then we will still have our public testimony time. So do you have handouts? Oh, okay. And in terms of public testimony, if you are interested in testifying tonight, if you can be sure to sign in on that sheet in the back indicating that you'd like to testify, and then we'll pick that up in a couple minutes here. So, well, there's four of you, so sorry. So we'll begin with Bloomington. Dr. Karen Cadigan is here from Bloomington Public Schools. And did you have a computer presentation or just
no.
a handout? Okay.
And we'll be...
Welcome to the committee. And
briefish. You. Can you hear me okay?
You need to really speak
okay.
closely
I can
to
do that,
that microphone. It's
great.
A little better.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We're here to share promising practice for local child care training. My name is Dr. Karen Cadigan, and I'm the Early Childhood Specialist for Bloomington and Richfield Public Schools. I'm also on the board of the statewide organization PASSER, Parent Aware for School Readiness. A background of the why about how our school districts got interested in supporting child care providers is that we know that child care providers and the birth to five-year-olds they support have the least per child dollar amount of public support compared to K-12 and compared even to higher ed. So we wanted to do some resource sharing. We know that child care providers are a critical part of our community's ability to raise healthy kids and get them ready for school. Our two districts have a long history of partnership in providing early childhood services. So I'm going to be speaking about both cities, Bloomington and Richfield, combined. We also, as it turns out, have a community public health department that is local that includes Bloomington, Richfield, and Edina, and a bit of the testimony will be given by my colleague from public health. Our communities have about 8,000 birth to five-year-olds. The majority of those children are non-white, that is Bloomington and Richfield. We have 112 family child care providers, 69 in Bloomington, 43 in Richfield. 45 centers, 27 in Bloomington and 18 in Richfield, for a total of 157 licensed providers. That's a lot of providers and a lot of children that are cared for before they ever walk in the school door. So using a model that has been successful in Greater Minnesota, you'll hear this from Wendy and Sandy both, we work together with public schools, public health, Hennepin County, Think Small, Hennepin County Family Child Care Providers, and other local organizations like the Works Museum to host child care appreciation events. So this is training in the context of a child care appreciation event. You have a couple of copies of those agenda in front of you, so you can get a sense of it. Just quickly, a few components that have made this a successful model. Number one, the events are held at a time that works for child care providers, that works for people that work 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. That means they're held on Saturday mornings. With topics that they report interest in, we are constantly in contact with the child care providers to make sure that what we're offering is relevant, and at times they even give input about which particular trainer they would like to see. We focus on both raising smart and healthy kids. This partnership between public health and education means we always have a component that's about kind of academics and also about health and nutrition. It's local, meaning it's held in their community, not a far drive, and it's held in one of our school buildings, alternating between Bloomington and Richfield. Local organizations provide door prizes, books, and other resources as incentives, and they're free. They're always free. Oh, and there's food. Some of the outcomes we've seen, the attendance at these events have been between 25 and 75 providers. The 75 is particularly memorable because it was on a beautiful sunny Saturday in May, and everyone came that said they were going to come. Providers rate the trainings as very good to excellent. They've consistently asked for more such events. Providers appreciate being connected to the school and being seen as important. A really striking thing is that when door prizes are awarded, we do drives for like Caribou Coffee Card, grocery store gift baskets. People always go for books. People would take a single book over a Byerly's gift basket. Providers want more resources. And finally, the relationship building between child care providers and school staff has resulted in various follow-up conversations and partnerships, which have been great. I'm going to turn it over to our main partner at Public Health to talk a bit more about providing support collectively for the family, friend, and neighbor providers, especially in the immigrant community.
Hi, I'm Joan Bolfer. I'm from Bloomington Public Health, and as Karen said, we serve the communities of Bloomington, Edina, and Richfield. We have funding through the Statewide Health Improvement Program and also a short-term grant through SNAP Ed Community Partnership to train and support child care providers to increase children's physical activity and to improve nutrition. We offer child care provider trainings to licensed providers, and we reach out to diverse communities to connect family, friend, and neighbor providers to resources. Anecdotally, many of our immigrants are either taking care of their own children or they're using family, friend, and neighbor care, especially for children's birth to three. For example, in Bloomington and Richfield, it is nearly impossible for low-income Latinos to benefit from high-quality licensed child care because of cost, language, and cultural barriers. Latino parents are concerned about the quality of the child care that their children have. They know it's loving care because it's friends and family. But they know that they don't have the background to give them the same quality of care that they may have if they could afford to put them into licensed care. One family, our community member, told public health staff, "I'm worried because our children are," she used the word fatter, "and not as well prepared for kindergarten." So family, friend, and neighbor caregivers in general only get some support, and if they do not speak English or are new immigrants to the community, they really don't get very much support. So the school district and public health, we recognize this lack of support for some of our newest immigrants as a big issue and have stepped up to offer training and support to family, friend, and neighbor providers so that they're more able to provide a healthy and academically rich environment in their homes. For example, over the last 3 years, we've used a community engagement model to provide training and support to over 200 Spanish-speaking family, friend, and neighbor providers with training that integrates nutrition and physical activity, best practices with school readiness skills. And the reason why we do that, you're familiar with the Statewide Health Improvement Program. We can only work on nutrition and physical activity. And so we have to integrate school readiness into that so that they can get what they really want, which is to get their kids ready for kindergarten. And so that's where the partnership with the school has been really helpful for us. As a result of our work and experience, other partners have become interested in examining the role of family, friend, and neighbor providers in early care and education, and explore how to help support this very important group of child care providers more. Thanks for letting us share our promising practice with you, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And who would like to go next? Either one. Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sandra Seymour. I work with Families First of Minnesota. We're located in Rochester, and I'm the education director there. And we were fortunate to receive an Early Head Start Child Care Partnership Grant, which were awarded first. It was nationally awarded, and they first were awarded in January of 2015. So what that means is that they wanted to take the Early Head Start performance standards and embed them in child care centers that are serving those families that are eligible for Head Start, which means 100% of poverty or below are receiving public assistance. And so we entered that journey with several partners, including partners in Winona County, Rice County, and Olmsted County, child care partners. And then also we partnered with some Head Start programs who were administering Head Start in those counties too. And so what it really was is to bring those additional resources to the infants and toddlers in the care. And so the Head Start performance standards really have to be met in those partnerships, and they gave us 18 months to do that. And what that meant was a lot of training. And what we did was we did training along with web-based training, and we provided laptops for the staff for them to be able to access the web-based training. We provided group trainings specifically around the use of research-based curriculum and assessment tools for infants and toddlers. And then we also provided, I think the secret ingredient is coaches. Coaching for those child care teachers directly on the use of the curriculum and the use of the assessment tools, and also with some other concerns that they may have. One of the Head Start performance standards is that we have to have 10% children with disabilities located in the centers, and so we provided some additional supports for those centers in working with children with disabilities. And also, because this was a federal to local grant, we asked for resources to improve the classroom environments, the playground environments, and other supports for those centers, including an enhancement fee that we contracted with the centers for them to get we contracted for $6,000 per child per year for each child that was enrolled as an Early Head Start child care in their center, in addition to what they received for child care assistance and other fees. So this was a way for them to meet some of the additional requirements around lower staff-to-child ratios. So that for Head Start, it's one teacher to every four children, infants and toddlers, and also some of the other requirements. But a real key to that was to have a coach who would work directly with the teachers, and that coach also worked with the families. So part of their job was to work to support the teachers, and the other part was to do the family support pieces for Head Start. And I just want to share with you one of the success stories that we have, because it really is about what happens then as an outcome of these partnerships. We had a family referred to Head Start from Crisis Nursery, which is a child abuse prevention service in our community. And the family had been using various child care but did not have a consistent provider. The family was on the wait list for child care assistance and could not afford most of the care offered in the community. The mom faced losing her job due to attendance because she didn't have care for her child. We were able to enroll the family in Early Head Start and place them in a child care partnership. We learned the child had a disability, and this was a factor in her finding constant provider. After 1 year with consistent care and a high-quality child care, the child made significant gains and no longer qualifies for special education services. So that's the result of what additional support and training can do for these our most at-risk children. And I just want to say, too, that we partnered with ParentAware, with a develop system, so that we were having our trainings approved by their system, the child care providers and child care centers could get credit through those developed systems too, towards what they need to have for licensing.
Great. Thank you. And Wendy?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Can you hear me okay? All right. My name is Wendy Wahlberg, and I represent Child Care Aware system.
Speak closer to the microphone, please. Thanks. It has to be pretty close to be.
Okay. As I said, my name is Wendy Wahlberg, and I work for Child Care Aware, representing the Northeast District. We serve 17 counties in northeastern Minnesota. I've been asked to talk about the training delivery through the Child Care Aware system. Professional development through Child Care Aware, it offers training opportunities for the day-to-day challenges providers face in keeping children engaged and happy in care, observing and assessing the children's needs, preparing them to be school-ready, and also provider business and professionalism. Our training is coordinated with the Minnesota Center for Professional Development. It's grounded in the state-approved Minnesota Knowledge and Competency Framework, as well as the Early Learning Standards. And it's designed to expand the knowledge, skills, attitudes, and beliefs of those who care for children. Our training is planned for the different experience levels of providers and also in a variety of time frames. So we'll do weekends or weeknights, different formats. We do face-to-face, we do online, and we do conferences and different settings. So our locations could be schools, churches, restaurants, wherever we can find a space, and sometimes in the rural areas that can be a challenge. Our training is geared to prepare the providers for the pre-licensing requirements, for licensing regulations, for their parent-aware rating, and also to lead to credentials such as the Minnesota Child Care Credential, the Infant and Toddler Credential, and the National Child Development Associate. We support providers in their search for training by tracking their record on the Minnesota new website called Develop. We offer no and low-cost training, and we schedule classes by assessing the needs of providers by taking a look at those that are in the parent-aware training or in the parent-aware cohorts and what trainings they will need for the rating that they are looking for. We offer training for those in the licensing process, those who are relicensing, and for the family, friend, and neighbor providers. To schedule our classes, we follow a rotation for each catalog period, which is 3 times a year, and we fill in with classes that are requested or mandatory or interesting to providers. And typically in our district, we offer 150 to 200 classes in a catalog period. So I'm sure you can imagine the coordination of that is huge, but we have generous funding from the Department of Human Services, and we had funding through Race to the Top dollars that have helped us support the level of training that we have been able to do in the past 3 years. There is a lot riding on these classes that we offer. Parent-aware ratings depend on the availability of classes, grant requirements, and also the needs for licensing. So with that, I'd just like to say that in talking with my counterparts, they wanted me to share that there are some challenges with that. And so as I share challenges, it isn't to focus on the challenge necessarily, but to address concerns that people in this room have had regarding training, but also it gives me an opportunity to highlight some of the work that we're doing out in the field for the professional development system and how that has influenced our model of training delivery. So first of all, we're experiencing a shortage of trainers. All trainers and training must be approved by the Center for Professional Development. And so sometimes this can be time-consuming, and we lose trainers. There's trainer of training sessions. Typically, those have been in the metro area, and so our out-state partners and trainers limiting for them. Because of the travel and things like that. What are we doing about that? We have a professional development staff that's awesome in checking trainers for their expiration dates in the Minnesota Center for Professional Development so we don't lose them, to watch the trainings and so those do not expire as well. Child Care Aware is now offering free or reduced training of trainers, and a lot of those are now online, so that is getting better. In the Northeast District, too, we're partnering with our initiative foundations, and so that has been a huge project for us, but also a blessing in the fact that they help support our training with offering more classes, with offering some incentives for participation, and for offering food, which is nice to get providers to come. And so that blending of public and private dollars has really been great for our training delivery. Recruitments are underway to build a stronger training base across the state, and this is a deliberate focus not only from our Child Care Aware Coordinating Office in St. Paul, but also the local district sites. Our second challenge is that we are experiencing, because of the lack of trainers, we also experience a lack of training. At times, the trainers have to drive a long distance to serve us and put on the classes that we're asking them to do. But what we're doing about that is that we are grateful for the Minnesota Child Care Aware Coordinating Office and the way that they offer Eager to Learn trainings and Anytime Learnings online. And that has been a great help to outstate Minnesota to give the training that the providers are needing. However, sometimes those classes fill quickly, so they're not available. And also, online training isn't always the best for some of the providers. They'd rather be face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So as we brainstorm to meet that challenge, we have also been offering some classes like through ITV and mediated telepresence. So we will do a live location and then ITV that to some other locations. And that has helped mostly in the rural areas where we typically had to cancel classes because we did not get enough participants. But now if we're at an ITV site, we can have one or two participants there and we don't have to cancel the class because the trainer may be at a different site. So that was a success story for us this last year. And then thirdly, in Minnesota, we have technology gaps still in northern Minnesota. Though the mediated telepresence has helped some because we can offer classes like at the colleges, for instance, outstate. And we have done some Chromebook labs where we'll bring actual computers, and we have some MiFis out to some locations. And if we can find a building in a remote town where that has Wi-Fi, we can actually assist some providers in taking the course right there. And we had a success story of a provider who took an anytime learning with our Chromebook lab. She was afraid of computers, but she got online. She signed on to develop, got her membership, took her class online, and when she got her certificate at the end of the night, you would have thought she graduated from college. She was so proud of that certificate. So we are seeing some advances in that area, but having internet access is a challenge. We take many phone calls every day to support providers in their efforts around licensing and pre-licensing parent-aware classes and what they need. Our coaches, our develop ambassadors, our PD staff are very supportive with one-on-one assistance with the providers, with meeting with the associations, talking with center directors, and working with the child care licensors. So we have tried to meet the needs of providers in those ways by helping them realize different methods that they could maybe get their training. And then with the costs reduced with DHS funding, that has also helped us. We have also done what we call on-demand classes where a center may call us and need a certain class for parent-aware, and instead of trying to schedule that, we will just go to their site and do it for their staff. So that, again, has reduced costs, but also has given the providers what they need to get the rating that they need. So I would just like to say that though we still have work to do in making sure that training is accessible and affordable to all providers when they need it, in the midst of all the changes that we have experienced, we are adjusting to that. We are marketing our Parent Aware and our Develop, and we fully support our providers and try to come up with innovative ways to teach them and help them find training, and best of all, that will benefit the children in their care. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all for your testimony. Do members have any questions for any of the participants? Senator Johnson?
To commend you for your ideas that you have put forth in front of us, and some of them looked like they could be used throughout the state of Minnesota, and thanks a lot.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Any other questions? I'll just I just one question. In terms of sustainability of some of the things you have going on, I heard mention of Race to the Top grant money and the Early Head Start partnership money. Is that... do you know how long some of these grant opportunities will exist, or for the early child or the early Head Start partnerships? Is that a time limited period that you have access to the additional funding?
Madam Chair, we're awarded an initial 5-year grant, and unless we do something to that would make them take our grant away, we would continue that as long as there's federal funding. And it's part of the federal Head Start budget, so it'll be continued funding.
Okay. And as far as other challenges you face in terms of funding the training, would you say that it's still, do you have funding streams that are ending soon or dependent on year to year? I don't know if...
Madam Chair, I would just say that I know the Race to the Top grant is ending this calendar year. The other kind of overarching issue, I think, is that what we have been talking about here is really the supply side of childcare and using funding streams as we can to support the supply side. But in order to really balance things out in the long run, we probably need to focus a lot more on the demand side. That is how much money families are able to spend to be able to afford childcare. So there's always that kind of tension between, no matter if money's available, which sort of side of the business is it for.
Madam Chair, with our model, a community engagement model with our Latino family, friend, and neighbor providers, we are actually working on helping them sustain their own program. So they are slowly taking over a lot of the things that happen. We offer training once a month. They're doing all the registering. They're getting the meals because there's always food involved. They're preparing meals. They are calling people to remind them to come. And I think that, as always, funding's always an issue because really, honestly, we offer the training for free, but trainings aren't free. And so we are trying to connect them with a lot of community resources that would be very interested in providing training to that particular group because they are very low income. Their children tend to be the least ready for kindergarten. Their children have the lowest high school graduation rates. There's a lot of interest in the community to support this group. And so I think that they will continue because they are so invested themselves in having it continue.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you all for coming tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we have a few few people who are here who wish to testify. First, I'll call up Claire Sanford and Allie Zomer. And then I have Jennifer Bestgen, and Lisa Thompson, and Jennifer Parrish and Amy O'Brien. Those are those we have listed. And if you would like to proceed, Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford, and I am representing the Minnesota Child Care Association, which is a statewide association of about 250
licensed child care centers. I have to eat the microphone. Is that better? Okay. And I'm also an employee of New Horizon Academy. And thank you for this task force's attention to the crisis of child care in our state. Spoiler alert, I'm going to ask for more money, which we've talked about tonight, which is heartening. Well, there are many issues facing the field of child care. The lack of investment in it from a financial standpoint is really our number one issue. And as long as it's an under-resourced and undervalued profession, wages and compensation will remain so low that people simply cannot do it and will not move into the field. Expectations keep rising. We've talked a lot tonight about training and education for providers and teachers. And Rep. Albright, you called the question. You know, we want people to get more education, but that doesn't allow them to charge higher rates. It doesn't allow them to have a better profit and loss statement at the end of the day. It is better for kids, and it's better for our economy, and it's better for the economic future of Minnesota, because all the research we have says that programs have to be high quality in order to get those returns on investments. So you have to have the educated staff, but it's a real conundrum in terms of how that translates to wages and compensation for people in the field. There are two programs. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. There are two programs that are national models but Minnesota run that already exist. They're called TEACH and RETAIN. Those are acronyms for longer things. TEACH, I believe, was mentioned earlier. That's a program to help providers gain access to scholarship dollars to improve their education and gain more credentials, which is great. We want them to do that. But I think the more pertinent issue for tonight is the program called RETAIN, which is a program that actually gives financial bonuses, straight financial bonuses like a salary, to providers who have already invested in their education. They've reached a certain level, and they can earn up to $3,500 in cash through that program. That program is meant to reward early educators for continuing their education, but also to stay in the field. That's the point of the extra money, to keep them in the field. They also have to commit to staying at their current employer for at least a year after they get that money. Unfortunately, in Minnesota's system, you can only apply every other year, and you know, teachers' mortgages, as Ms. Zomer told me earlier today, I really liked it. She said, you know, teachers' mortgages don't go down every other year. So if there's not consistent funding to keep people in the field, that's kind of a technical fix that we should look at. But it's mainly funded, TEACH and RETAIN are funded through federal dollars. They haven't gotten state investment since 2011, which is also the year that child care assistance rates were frozen for providers at the 25th percentile of 2011 rates. So the wheel is there. We don't need to reinvent it. We could put some state funds into those programs to help retain educators and actually give them a boost to their compensation. However, last year, the RETAIN program was only able to serve 187 people. It's projected to serve 50 fewer already this year. So when you're looking at statewide public policy, that is a tremendous drop in the bucket in terms of affecting the entire field. What we really need is to stop nipping at the edges of the problem. I like food, so I always think of things in food, and I feel like we're talking about legitimate issues with licensing and training and delivery systems, but I feel like we got a big pan of burned lasagna, and all of those issues are totally legitimate, but are kind of nipping some of the burned edges away, and we're not getting to the heart of the meal, which is the workforce, the providers, and without more financial resources, we're not going to be able to move this needle, and I feel like the lasagna is getting old and it's getting cold, and by the time we get to it, we're all going to have food poisoning, which is not good if we don't invest in our workforce. I know that was terrible. These are the things that come out of my head. So we need a big investment in early childhood. It's frustrating to see the focus continue to be kind of nipping around the edges of the problem instead of just facing the fact that we're so under-resourced. We need to come into compliance with federal law around the Child Care Development Block Grant, which rules our CCAP program. We need to meet new federal regulations. Minnesota's not in compliance yet. We need to raise reimbursement rates for providers. More resources to providers translates to more the ability to pay more in wages. We need to have an honest discussion in Minnesota about what a push for universal pre-K for four-year-olds will do to our state's ability to provide, really, as you said, Senator Johnson, even more critical care for infants and toddlers, where we know so much of that brain development is happening. And the economics just don't work if you pull all of the four-year-olds out and child care providers can't
make the economics work to serve infants and toddlers and three-year-olds. We need to expand Parent Aware so that more providers can access quality improvements and the financial incentives that come with them and the additional revenue streams that come with them. We need to look at tax credits for families so they have more ability to pay more for childcare. There's just a whole slew of things that we need to do, and it's not popular to say we need more money, but we need more money in this field. And every year it gets more expensive to fix, and every year it gets ignored. So in closing, the wheel that's already invented, the teach and retain program, an investment of state resources there could help current educated educators stay in the early childhood field. But again, that's a drop in the bucket, and a lot of what we're talking about is legitimate and will no doubt help, but it's nibbling at the edges of the problem, and we really need the infusion of resources that this field is really has been crying out for so long. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Omer?
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, it's a little hard to follow Claire because she's pretty good at this, but my name is Allie Zomer, and I'm with Especially for Children. We are a locally owned and family-run child care center. We have 8 centers across the Twin Cities, and we are very proudly celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. So I want to thank you as well for convening this important conversation and for including diverse voices, whether they be from our state agencies, from our elected officials, from parents, from providers, who all have a shared stake in ensuring that our children get the best start in life. But you have a special role to play that none of the rest of us can fill, and that is you control the budget. And so I would like to echo Claire's comments that of all of the things that will make the greatest difference in access and affordability, funding is central to that picture. Claire explained really well the teach and retain program, so I won't rehash that. Just suffice to say that those are valuable tools that if fully invested in and spread throughout the early childhood landscape could make a real difference in providers' wages, which I think we've all identified are a crucial factor in keeping people in the field for the long run. The second area, though, that is woefully in need of investment is our CCAP program. So I want to highlight that because not only is it a key tool that affects access and affordability for families, but it also impacts the workforce. The Child Care Assistance Program is our primary means of supporting families with the highest financial need, and it does so at the earliest stage possible. So again, Senator Johnson, to your point, brain development doesn't start at 4 years old. It starts in infancy, and we have a system in place that could provide for those families immediately when they need it. Unfortunately, we have around 6,500 families on the wait list for CCAP today. So we are not funding the families who need it most at the age when they need it most. When we fund CCAP, those dollars allow families to obtain a spot at either a family child care provider or in center-based care. So those resources then flow to the provider who are able to offer meaningful wages either to themselves as the business owner and family child care's case, or to their staff as teachers in the case of centers. But unfortunately, the reimbursement we provide for accepting those CCAP scholarships is woefully low, 25th percentile of the 2011 rates. So providers want to take these children and want to serve these families, but it is financially unsustainable when those reimbursement rates don't cover the cost of caring for those children. So unfortunately, that means that many providers are not able to serve the community in the way that they might want to. So increasing the reimbursement rates for CCAP would not only help families access the care that they need, but it would also help providers to do what they want to do for families in their communities, which is serve them, but also ensure that they're able to pay their bills. And finally, I want to address the importance of maintaining a diverse field in early childhood and diverse options for parents.
centers, family child care homes, faith-based programs. These are all important in the mix of choices that I believe families should have when they decide how they want their children to spend their days. And they're important components of a system that allows families to be in charge of really meeting their own needs. Unfortunately, these diverse providers are being left out of the current voluntary pre-K system, which is heavily biased towards school districts. School districts are an important component of the picture, but unless we recognize that community-based providers are also important components, we will continue channeling resources away from them. And as Claire alluded to, the business model of a family child care home or of a center depends on a diverse mix of ages of children to spread out the cost, right? Infant and toddler care is very expensive. And so having preschoolers in your program allows you to share those costs across families. And so if we remove those preschoolers from family child care homes and from center-based care, the cost for caring for infants and toddlers is going to become untenable for families, and it's going to be nearly impossible, I think, for many providers to maintain their business and their livelihood. So thank you for convening us here and for being open to discussing these important issues of access and affordability.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight. I really appreciate it. And if you have written copies of your testimony, if you want to leave or email to us, we can take those as well. So
thank you.
And now I have Jennifer Bestian and Lisa Thompson. And hopefully I didn't mangle your last name too badly, but please introduce yourself for the record.
It's perfect.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bestian, and I am representing Family Child Care, Inc. from Olmsted County. We appreciate the recommendations you have on your agenda, and I will address some of them, but we also have several additional ones for you to consider. On the agenda under number 4, task, consider creation of the Board of Child Care to be responsible for all matters related to licensing of child care providers. We at FCCI think there needs to be clear expectations and responsibilities need to be carefully put together. Parameters need to be put in place so all geographic regions of the state are represented. This means that the access to technology is a must to make sure that meetings can be attended online. Otherwise, we will end up with all metro providers on the panel. The next task, uniform training requirements. We at FCCI agree that this is very important. We recommend mandatory annual training for licensors to create consistent enforcement of rules and statutes. Information on a common sense perspective to guiding, educating, and supervising children in a multi-age group. Training regarding child development, how to respond to providers' questions regarding rules, and offering support resources to providers to help them be successful. There should be required quarterly communications from licensing staff to providers that address frequent questions in the field. Any new interpretation providers should be aware of to be in compliance, and include a feedback loop for providers to send in a question for clarification without fear of future correction order based on the question. Number 5, training for all licensing. We at Family Child Care think the current pre-service training is all very important, but we would suggest that some of the requirements could be completed within the first 6 months. For example, CPR, first aid, SWID, and abusive head trauma should be done before being licensed. But supervising for safety and child development guidance, 2C, can be done within the first 6 months to alleviate much of the stress put on newly licensed providers. Right under that, training for the Parent Aware rating system. I am a Parent Aware 4-star rated provider, and I agree it's very important. However, for new providers, in order to retain them, it is critical to train them on the business aspect of family child care first. I remember being so overwhelmed in the first year and a half, trying to deal with late pickups, non-payments, caring for numerous children with all different wants and needs, having my house and paperwork in order, continuing classes after childcare hours. I went to bed every night wondering why in the world I was in this profession. After putting in a 12-hour day, my hourly wage was practically nothing. I think we need to first help new providers on the business aspect and then guide them to become parent-aware rated, or we will lose them. We at Family Child Care, Inc. have additional solution recommendations to address factors influencing the child care shortage and cost of care. One of the main factors is the Governor's Universal Preschool Program. Family child care programs' cost of care will double, or the program will cease to exist as 3- and 4-year-olds' children enter free preschool. From the presentation by First Children's Finance at the August Task Force meeting, every program in the sample served preschool-age children, and preschool tuition is made up on an average 45% of our tuition income. The importance of preschool tuition for the financial viability of family child care needs to be recognized, especially as the state considers universal pre-K. If a family child care providers are not able to care for preschool children, many may be unable to generate adequate revenue to continue operating. For further review, our solutions recommendations are available in the handouts tonight and are posted on the website. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much for providing the handout. And I believe, members, we have that one in our packet. So thank you for providing that today. Ms. Thompson?
Hi, my name is Lisa Thompson. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here and voice our concerns and our input on what the task force has before them. I'll make just a few points out of my testimony because I know that we're late on time. Some of the primary things that I want to make sure that are before this task force is that if there is a board created to address concerns about child care, I believe very strongly that it needs to be representative of the workforce and fairly elected from the workforce. If you don't include the people that do the work, we're going to continue to be over-regulated and not as doing our job as well as we could. I would hope that the task force would reserve a spot on any child care board specifically for immigrant and English language learners and any other underserved community within this profession. And if we have a dedicated advocate or liaison, that there's one specifically to that is not connected to DHS in protecting the people that do the work and give them the resources that they need in order to adequately do the job that we do. Representative Albright, you mentioned about the funding and further education. And first of all, I wanted to say that the education isn't just about getting better pay for the providers, but in higher job satisfaction. I know that the more education I have and I'm better able to do this job, I'm more satisfied in this job and I'm more likely to stay in this job and do a better job for families. When I'm doing a better job for families, I also maintain a full program. Children are being served better. And the other piece was about, and Senator Johnson, you alluded to this about it is a business. It is a free market, but it, like schools, is not one that can solely be funded and done on a market basis. And if we do it that way, only the wealthy will be well educated with a high quality care at the time that the most important brain development is happening. Unless we share this responsibility as a society to support this level of education, we're failing as a society. unless we equally support the providers so that we can adequately and beyond that, high-quality education for young children. The last thing that I just wanted to allude to here is many of the issues that have been brought before this committee have to do with, I think someone referred to it as nipping around the edges, and they're detailed issues that make a big impact on our day-to-day world, and it also is a big impact on why people leave this profession. But we haven't addressed some of the interpretive guidelines that could make this a lot easier for providers and counties and states to regulate the rules. There's so many. The rule was put in so long ago with all the other statutes on top of it that it's just a hodgepodge. Providers don't know how to stay in compliance. County workers often don't know how to regulate and help people be in compliance. And with these kind of guidelines, the county workers could return to their role as primary support for providers doing this job, rather than only being solely marginalized to regulating. I'm sorry, there was one other thing that I wanted to make sure. All the wonderful programs that you've heard about tonight, I really want you to notice that this is happening in the metro area. Providers outside of the metro area are not enjoying the luxury of free training. I've been a 4-star rated provider since the second cohort to the pilot program. I have benefited and enjoyed free training for years, but this is not something that my colleagues outside of the metro area enjoy, and it's absolutely vital that we fund the kind of programs that we already have available to providers to keep them in the field and support them in doing the important work that we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Did you provide your testimony?
I'm sorry?
Did you provide your testimony in email?
No, but I can.
Okay. That would be great.
I'll send it
Thank
tomorrow.
You. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. The last two names I have, Jennifer Parrish and Amy O'Brien. Please proceed and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Parrish. I'm a licensed family child care provider from Olmsted County and the public policy director for the Minnesota Association of Child Care Professionals, MACCP. MACCP is a voluntary association of licensed family child care providers whose mission is to strengthen the family child care profession by advocating for policy improvements, offering additional support and services to providers, and promoting family child care as an exceptional option for quality care and early childhood education. Because the decline in the number of child care slots in Minnesota has almost entirely come from family child care, I'd like to address this from the family child care standpoint. You've already heard from a number of testifiers in previous hearings about the changes and the challenges that family child care providers have experienced relating to the increased regulations and licensure requirements, as well as oversight that has become increasingly punitive in the last 5 years. All while simultaneously losing supports previously available to providers. These increasing demands and less supportive environment have played a key role in the loss of thousands of child care providers over the last decade. While many of these changes were well-intended, many were also unnecessary and resulted in fewer licensed child care spots, forcing many families to choose unlicensed, unregulated care, where the caregiver oftentimes has no annual training or even a background check. Or some parents have to make that hard choice to not work at all. And when qualified caregivers are not available, parents cannot work. And as you've already heard in previous meetings, this is contributing to a worker shortage in many areas, impacting every level of the economy. The first step to solving any problem is to acknowledge that there is one. And since we're here tonight, we've already done that. The second step is to fully identify it, and I don't believe we've done that yet. While we can point at all the problems and challenges family child care providers have experienced over the past five or six years, these are merely symptoms of a much bigger problem. We as Minnesotans have forgotten what family child care is supposed to be about. and we have not made the choice to value it for what it is. Allow me to explain this a little further. As lawmakers and oversight agencies have looked at family child care over the years, we've often been viewed as a less desirable option. There's a misconception that parents choose us because we're less expensive or because they either don't know enough about quality or they simply don't care about it. And that's been an increasingly popular catchword when looking to expand regulation and impose new requirements on family child care. Quality. We all want our children to have access to quality child care. The problem is that the word quality is a subjective word. What one parent, lawmaker, caregiver, or teacher believes to be a good quality child care program, another may disagree. Yet we have taken a specific vision of quality developed by government agencies and special interest groups, and we're increasingly trying to regulate and train all providers into this one vision of quality. In the process, we're losing many of the things that have made family child care unique and a preferred option for many families. In spite of the misconceptions I mentioned earlier, parents don't choose my program because I'm cheap. I assure you I'm not, and they'll be the first to tell you that. Parents choose my program and family child care because of the home-like environment. Their children are able to learn through fun activities like baking and exploring our surroundings. Because I only care for 8 children, I can offer lots of one-on-one attention. Each little one in my care is shown and told daily that they are loved. We snuggle up with books. We're silly together. I nurture them the same way that their parents would nurture them at home. My family is an extension of their family, and that is what they want for their children. That's why they choose my program. Yet with each passing legislative session, I see my home-based program being regulated more and more as though it were a center. And the dog food dish is kind of an example of that. We're taking the family out of family child care, and it's because we haven't made that choice yet as a state to value it for what it is and to protect it and celebrate it and preserve it. Through this process, we've also lost sight of something that's even more important. Each child is unique, and they each have different styles of learning, different social and emotional developmental needs. Some of them thrive better in a center, but many of them thrive better in a family-based environment like family child care. By choosing not to value and protect family child care, and by attempting to change it to meet that one vision of quality, we're denying thousands of children their best chance at a great start during those critical early years, because our state is limiting them to programs that we think are best for them versus what they actually need. So today, rather than sharing more stories of our broken child care system with you, MACCP would like to encourage this committee and its members to make the decision and the commitment to protect family child care the way that it should be, not as a center, not as a big box preschool, but for the unique and valuable choice that it offers parents. And from there, as you're looking at potential solutions, to really examine whether or not each one of them will preserve this precious option for Minnesota's children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. O'Brien?
Hi, Madam Chair and the committee. I am from Farmington, and I recently had a negative action placed against me for what I feel is a ridiculous reason. Excuse me. I had somebody moving into my home, so I submitted a background check on the person. And they passed their criminal background check, no problem, but they had an allegation against them. That person chose to fight the allegation disqualification for their own personal reasons because it affects them in other ways because it's a DHS disqualification. It's not just them living in my home because I have a family child care. It would also mean that they couldn't work with children in the community and other aspects, which they've been doing for years. The allegation was 6 years old, whatever. So because that person chose to appeal that, I was put on a conditional license for somebody that never lived in my home. We just submitted it because they were going to be living in my home. I told the social worker that obviously if they don't pass, then they're not, I mean, without a doubt, it's not happening. They're not coming in my home. I appealed it. I had an attorney. The commissioner denied it. I Still have no explanation at why, but the licensing worker said that this person was a threat to my daycare. How can they be a threat to my daycare when they've never lived in my home? Ever. Never lived in my home. They have their own lease on their own apartment, so on and so forth. I had an option to appeal it, but I've already spent thousands of dollars with the previous one being denied, and the attorney said that it could cost an additional $10,000 to continue with no guarantee that it will be dropped. I got an opinion from a second attorney in Minneapolis. These two attorneys have 65 years of experience in family child care law. He, too, advised me to just let it go, be on your conditional license for 2 years. My concern is that anybody that looks up my name now sees a negative action against me, and it says background check disqualified. Well, if I'm a mother looking for child care and I click on that, I'm moving on. That's hurting my business for something that I didn't do anything wrong, absolutely nothing wrong. This person never lived in my house. So the terms of my conditional license are the person doesn't live with me, and that once a month the licensing worker just stops by randomly whenever she gets a chance to make sure that I'm following this condition. I still have no explanation from anybody why they felt this person was a threat to my daycare when they've never lived in my house. I did everything I was asked, provided them with utility bills proving this person didn't live with me, you know, leases, the whole nine yards. And so I just think that some of these negative actions are being blown out of proportion. And in the long run, they are hurting me. I'm a small business. I'm a single woman supporting my father living with me. It's my only income. And I'm doing it because I love it. But I got bills to pay. And this person who doesn't even know me or know this other person is making these suggestions. And the background on that, when I say this, that the licensing worker doesn't know me, Dakota County has had an influx in licensors. I've been doing this for 2.5 years. I'm on my third licensor. And they have one position, I believe, still open. I didn't even know who my licensor was for 6 months. There was no communication, no nothing. So you'd call in. Your emails were never answered. They weren't forwarded anywhere. Nothing. And then you'd call in and you get transferred to any licensor. And when that person had time, they would return the call. So this whole process has taken a year. It's been a year. It's now finally done. And my conditional license starts for 2 years for something that I did nothing. I followed the state statute, which said that you needed to submit a paper that said change of household and a background check had to be submitted. I wrote on the paper, person not living in my house yet, potentially moving in. Licensing worker came out multiple times during the appeal process, interviewing me. You know, I felt like she was pretending like she was my best friend and was like on my side. And then for it to all come out now, for it to be she's the one that made the recommendation that she felt that that person was a threat to my daycare. She had the police report for the allegation, but the person passed the criminal background check. And this was an allegation, and an allegation is an allegation. And the bottom line is the person's never lived, you know, they don't live with me. So now my business suffers because of that licensing worker's recommendation.
Well, I really appreciate your coming to share your information. It sounds like a really difficult, really challenging situation, and I would hope that that you do receive a response and further information if you did not receive any information after the last response from the department. I don't know what I can take your name and number. We can talk with the county representatives or representatives from Dakota County last time and the department and see if I can get some additional information between you and the department.
I think I put my phone number on the paper, but yeah, I can.
Yep, we've got it okay. here. So
thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you.
And that concludes our public testimony portion. Members, I apologize for going long again, but every meeting we've had a great deal of information to cover and a lot of good discussion, I think, for members to have as well. So I really appreciate your taking time to stay longer. We will be sending out emails to try and schedule a November meeting soon and get your feedback on when you'd be available. Any other questions? I'm sorry. Somebody is. Oh, I'm sorry.
I did not know that I signed up in the back. I also called today to speak today, so I don't know what I missed.
Oh, I apologize. I have the lists here, and I just maybe we overlooked a name. I'm sorry.
My name's Carlene Janaski.
Maybe we just.
Okay. Just come up.
Carlene, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Oh. Go ahead and come up. I'm sorry.
Duluth is my hometown.
I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
I promise I will be there.
Okay.
But I guess, I'm sorry, I'll sit down first.
Yeah. And please just state your name for the record again.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chairman and Committee. My name is Carlene Danaski, and I am what you have all been speaking about tonight. I am all of those things. I am the family child care provider. I am the college-educated professional. I am a trainer in the Northeast District. Yeah, we drive a lot. I run a 4-star parent aware program in Carleton County in a rural spot in Renshaw, Minnesota. I am a retained recipient right now. I am starting my master's degree next week. Yippee. In early childhood public policy and advocacy, honestly. I am going to be getting a TEACH grant to be getting through that process in getting the graduate certificate first. I was recruited and work hand-in-hand with Northland Foundation in the Duluth community. They are doing amazing, amazing things with that combination of private and public funds. Amazing. I am a business owner. Thank you for acknowledging that. I have often been told not to talk about the money, and that really bugs me. And because I don't do this for free, I can't. I'm a single mother raising 4 children. I have 3 that just finished college and 1 10-year-old back at home. I see all ends of this. My program itself is called the Backyard Play School, which is exactly what we do. We play every day. We love, we play. I create brain and neural connections, 700 to 1,000 every second in those little babies that I hold and I comfort when their moms walk out the door because they don't know what to do with all those emotions. That's my job. Is knowing and understanding that every day, and it's what we do. It is the hardest profession to stay in. I hope you really understand that. It is hard to stay in a job where you work 12 hours a day, hands-on, and that doesn't include 50 to 120 hours of training I take every year. That doesn't include driving the distances, being recruited to be a trainer, and then educating my community, participating in child care association meetings so that we can educate those that are new and mentor those coming into the profession. I shop, I plan, I lesson plan, I do all of those things, and the paperwork. In 22 years, that's how long I've been doing this. This is my 22nd year. According to Malcolm Gladwell, an expert, tips out at 10,000 hours. I hit 67,000 this year. 67,000 in my years. I love what I do. I'm passionate about what I do. I'm passionate about these people, and their parents. Their parents are incredible. They're brave. They're strong. They get their kids to me on time. How do they do that? They're amazing. And they do it on a dime. They are struggling to pay for everything. So if you can embrace that and know that what we're doing in this profession is so important, those retained grants are huge. The parent aware process is wonderful. there are some glitches. We need to help with that. We need to keep funding it. We need to offer those classes at reduced rates in greater state Minnesota. We need to be able to get to them, find them. We need to know about Eager to Learn. Eager to Learn is great. I take a lot of my classes online. My internet can be really, really touchy. So that can be an issue, even worse farther out. The Eager to Learn has been an amazing source for us in greater state. Fund that. The Parent Aware is wonderful. Probably the biggest glitch I see is when we go from a 2-star to a 3 or a 4 and we have to add the paperwork to what we already do. We already lesson plan. We already use a curriculum. We already know our philosophy. We already assess those kids and adjust our lessons and do something different the next day to build those little skills that they need. But now we have to document all that. We have to do that an 11-hour day watching anywhere from 8 to 12 children from 6 weeks to 11 years old and be able to address all of those age groups. We don't just get a narrow little avenue. We've got it all. And we have to be experts everywhere, every day, all the time. And so to support those families and to support those providers in making that switch, if you want them to stay rated, they need to know how to do that next step, how to do that paperwork, how to have somebody really help them understand what is curriculum, what does that mean, and get there. And these courses and classes do that. As a trainer for the state now, I was recruited through the Northland Foundation, part of the Parent Aware initiative that they have, and they pay for most of my TOTs. In fact, tomorrow they have given me a grant to go and see Dr. Bruce Perry speak down in Burnsville, and he is a traumatic brain specialist. And he has studied the effects of the children from Waco and the kids from 9/11 and the differences in how their lives turn out based on the traumatic stress that they've experienced in their life. I wouldn't have that access or the funds to pay for those kind of trainings without the Northland Foundation. And those kind of things carry over because guess what? I go home and I talk about this to every parent that comes through, and I educate them, and then they grow and they learn. They treat their children differently, and it spreads like a ripple in our communities. I have worked so hard. I have brought about 12 to 15 providers in my area into the Parent Aware process, mentoring them. I was the first one in our county to jump on board. I did it because I needed to be treated like an equal and as a professional in the field of early care. I am an educator first. I've had people look at me and say, but you're not a teacher. And I went, wow, I really have a big job to do because I need you to see me as one. That means I've dropped the ball somewhere. I need you to see me as a teacher. I need you to see me as a teacher of these little lives that are important, so important to our economy, to our future, to everything. And so I really encourage you to look at the work that you're doing in our workforce. People are leaving. Some are aging out. I'm 50 years old. I'm getting tired after 67,000 hours, but I love it. And I'm bringing young ones into the field and encouraging them. And that's what they need. They need to be encouraged and not dogged. I've seen the switch in paperwork. When I started, it was 2 papers, the admission paper and the immunization record. That's all I had to have. Now I have a packet. I have a 3-ring binder that's 3 inches thick. And I have to know every statute. And I spent a month last year going through that new statute, piece by piece by piece, creating a policy for my program that addressed every piece. I've shared that in my community so that other providers don't have to do the same thing. Those are the kind of supports that providers need. Those statutes are confusing, and how to put them in there and how to write those policies and make sure that you are compliant, because we want to be. So how can we do that? We are fortunate in Carleton County. We had one licensor for 47 years, and now we've got a new gal, and she's just as great. And she does her job, and we know we need to dot our I's and cross our T's. But she also will walk us through what we've needed to learn and grow. But we have lost from 70-plus providers down to under 50 is where we fluctuate. I have my entire program right now is 2 and under. I went from 17 children on my roster this summer to 7. I have 1 4-year-old left, 1 3-year-old. My children are aging out almost 1.5 to 2 years earlier than they used to 20 years ago. And that's affecting my business. I don't know if I can keep my doors open to serve my community. I live about 25 miles south of the Duluth area, and I have three families that drive from Duluth down to me in order to put their children in infant care that's at a quality place. They drive almost an hour to get to me, so it's amazing. So I would suggest and really just hope that you understand who we are as a profession and how important the work that you guys are doing to see that and really put those dollars where they're going to matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, and I apologize for missing you. So,
thank you.
Thank you for your
the
time.
The fog was worth it.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Definitely was. Again, we will work to schedule the November meeting, and this meeting is adjourned.
Thanks for coming out. Thanks, John. All right.